Brilliant Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From the cavernous depths of the hollow earth, it's your one-stop shop for the strange, the unusual. You know what it is. It's the Grailian Report, and I'm your happy, very humble host, Mr. Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, joining you live every week, Tuesday evenings from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. It is the Grailian Report, and I'm joined in studio, as always, by our fantastic and very friendly Grailian staff. To my right, the incomparable producer extraordinaire, Mr. Chris Hayes. Chris, how are you?
How dare you spread lies about me, friendly.
I should be nicer, shouldn't I? Also, sitting directly behind him on a master console, the likes of none you've ever seen, the one and only, the reverend himself, Mr. Matt Oakley. Matt, how are you?
Yeah, you know.
I don't know. Why don't you tell me?
Oh, my God. I think we started a previous show like this.
Yeah, we did. Something like that.
I'm all right.
Fantastic. I'd like to invite you, all our dear listeners out there in internet radio land, to join us on a creepy investigation of the ethereal variety. It is the Grailian Report. That's what we do every week on this program from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, throughout the program, periodically we'll be taking your calls live in studio 828-398-4886 and on Skype ID Grailian Report. But before we get to the telephones, I thought we'd put out some good news to share with our kindred out there in Gradio Land, because we are always glad to have good news, and I think I'm well equipped to share a little bit with you this week. As most of you who have been following the podcast over the last few days have already noticed, indeed, we are back online. In the short period of hours following last week's broadcast, the Grailian Report, well, we managed to get back online, not only with the podcast, but the website's back up. Everything is back to normal. We have not been silenced for long. Those forces of destruction and malintent that would try and keep, well, your favorite neighborhood Grailians from you, well, we've overcome those obstacles and those adversaries. The Hadals had nothing to do with it. I'll just go ahead and tell you that right up front. And we are back and better than ever before. Let me just tell you how much better we're doing. First of all, the podcast is now being hosted through the fine folks over at Liberated Syndication. And in the last week alone, we have just about doubled the download rate, okay, of the most recent edition of the Grailian Report. In the past, you know, we've been getting pretty good traffic. Our numbers in the last week have doubled. So I guess the old adage that, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, remember that one? Well, apparently it's true, because in our short four-day absence from the web, apparently our listening audience has doubled. My God, all I can do is just thank you. Those of you listening, those of you who will be downloading the podcast, thank you, thank you, thank you. We appreciate you so much. As some of you who visited the website have seen also, we now have a PayPal donate button available. And with our server costs and all the expenses that go into putting this program on the air, we've been inviting people to visit www.grailienreport.com. And in the middle column, right under the search bar, you'll see a donate button for PayPal. All you have to do is just hook up, sign in, donate an amount in U.S. dollars. We don't have a set amount. You can donate a dollar for all I care. You can donate $100. But we've had a lot of folks who have very generously been contributing to this program and to helping us continue to provide insightful and compelling commentary to you on a weekly basis, live from hundreds of miles below the earth here in the Grailian bunker. We are your light in the darkness, and we're very glad to continue to bring you information on a weekly basis that is well fit for your approval, my friends. So for all your donations, for all your support, for all your insights and your commentary and feedback, we thank you so much. The program keeps growing and getting bigger and bigger. And I tell you, I've been recently advising some friends of mine who have done both actual, you know, terrestrial radio and even internet radio. I'll tell you what, internet broadcasting is a wonderful thing, but there's nothing quite like the ability to There's nothing quite like the ability to provide a podcast that people can download and take with them on the air. That's what we're doing now, and you know, this is probably some of the best feedback I've gotten of the many web endeavors I've been involved with in the past. So that said, we've gotten those server issues that we were faced with last week taken care of, and we of course continue to ask you and we remain grateful for your many contributions, including donations you can make by visiting the Grailian Report website. While you're there at the Grailian Report website, I do want to direct your attention to the two primary hosts. First of all, Something I put up earlier today that I think folks will probably find interesting was an article asking essentially whether is it possible that interest in unexplained phenomena at an early age might promote artistic abilities. There have been people on my Facebook page and also people there at the website who've been engaging in a bit of commentary about that. So while you're at GrayleanReport.com, I encourage you, you don't have to even register your name or an email. You can remain completely anonymous, but you can leave comments there at the website. So check out Art of the Anomalist. Does interest in the unexplained promote artistic abilities? You can leave your commentary about whether you think people who are young and interested in UFOs and Bigfoot and the like might have a greater aptitude for artistic abilities and musicality. I know I've been known for being a musician and an artist and, of course, a writer for a number of years, and those are all things that I began to get interested in when I was very young. And this, of course, for me, is pretty obvious, coincided with my interest in UFOs and Bigfoot and strange phenomena, to the point that a few of my teachers in grade school, I remember this fondly now, I remember specifically my third grade teacher, very much disapproved of the fact that my parents had exposed me to UFOs and strange phenomena and that they allowed me to read books like this. And, of course, they had conferences and would say, you know, you should really think about trying to get him interested in something like history or something like that. And they're like, well, he's interested in all that stuff, too. He just happens to also like Loch Ness Monsters and UFOs. What's wrong with that? He's reading. Is it really that big a deal? He's going to rot his mind, they said. Obviously, my mind is rotten. I'll let you listeners be the judge of that one. In other news, I do also want to tease what we're going to be getting to later in the program, because if you're at the website, you've already seen the primary post we have right there, front and center at GrayleanReport.com, a special Mac Tony's tribute here on the Graylean Report. And yes, tonight we will be joined in Hour 3 by a very special guest. He's a friend and a mentor to me, and someone whose insights into the field of ufology probably are unsurpassed by none. It's Dr. Maxim Ivanovich Kammerer, and Dr. Kammerer is going to be joining us to discuss Mac Tony's, the implications of his research, not only into UFOs and similar phenomena, but also what Mac thought about the future of humanity. You know, I think Mac was one that called himself essentially a transhumanist, and he was truly, truly one of the great minds in esoterica and the unexplained. He passed away, get this, exactly 2 years ago today. For those of you listening to the live broadcast, it is October 18th, 2011. And on this very day, in 2009, we lost one of the great minds in the field of the esoteric, Mr. Mac Tony's. I had only begun to get to know Mac when he died rather inexplicably due to heart complications. For more on him and his life, you can visit Wikipedia, but I implore you and encourage you to stick around for Hour 3 of tonight's broadcast, where we get into a very interesting conversation with Dr. Maxim Kammerer about Mac Tony's. We get into some of Mac's influences, especially Jacques Vallée, and what all this had to do with not just UFOs, but the future of humanity here on planet Earth. I'll tell you, it's going to be a wild ride. It's not the kind of thing that you're going to want to miss, and that's right here on the Graylean Report during Hour 3 of tonight's program. But that said, we'll get away from the news for just a minute. I'm sure we're going to end up talking a little bit about the Wall Street protest, but first I'd like to ask my in-studio staff, gentlemen, how are we tonight? Matt, I know you and I, we had lunch with a couple of financial advisors today, and we won't give out their names. You know, I think that they probably appreciate us respecting their anonymity, but we met today for lunch with a couple of very respected brokerage assistants, I guess you'd call them, the financial advisors. These gentlemen,
I mean, just general financial advisors.
These gentlemen are, I'll tell you this though, when it comes to the understanding of economics, these are two of the smartest gentlemen that anyone could ever hope to sit down and have a conversation with. And why were we talking with them, Matt? What about financial advice and stock brokerage and investment assistance could have interested us here at the Grayling Report? Why would we find that kind of thing interesting?
Well, I think the catalyst that really got us talking with them was the whole Occupy Wall Street protest.
Absolutely.
And the whole idea that Wall Street was behind this whole financial collapse.
Now, it would probably be wrong to say that they're you know, that Wall Street you know, didn't have something to do with it. But now I'll tell
definitely.
But you know, there are always those who are looking to lay the blame. Now, I think that last week on the program, when we had our field correspondent from New York, the lovely Miss Anya Briggs on the program to talk about that, hopefully I think that the listeners would agree that we put forth a what I consider to be a pretty fair and balanced, to borrow the expression that one of the mainstream news agencies uses these days, Which, yeah, a lot of people would say that they use it, you know, rather inappropriately. But either way, yes, I think that we did try to remain fair and balanced. And we always do here at the Graylian Report. And that's why, from time to time, especially entering an election year like we're about to do, it is always important that we do spend a little bit of time talking about current events and world news, in addition to the strange and the unusual. You know, I had a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, actually, last week say, I was very glad to see that you gentlemen were going to talk about the Wall Street occupation, because this is, you know, these are signs of the times, and this is something that is going to be immediately important to us here on planet Earth, probably more important than whether or not aliens exist. I'm sorry, Chris, our producer is now turning red in the face. Now, let me just tell you, before anyone gets angry, go ahead, Chris, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm not turning red in the face.
You're Irish, that's right. You're always a little red in the face.
Well, yeah, but I just made the noise because, yeah, well, the 99% versus the 1% could be important depending on your perspective. But if aliens are going to come down and rain fiery nuclear gamma death on us, I think that's a little more important than who pays what in taxes.
The problem is that ideologically, people don't typically look at the idea of aliens from outer space and look at it very seriously. Now, and here's the thing, we've addressed this on the program in the past before. I, okay, am not a person who endorses a literal extraterrestrial hypothesis, okay, to explain the multitude of things that probably constitute what we call UFOs. I would say that 90%, maybe 95% or better, are man-made aircraft, but that they are intelligently controlled. And that, to me alone, is very interesting, that there are agencies, government agencies, organizations, private industry, I don't know, all these different potential organizations that, and the thing is we don't know who it is, but you can't deny, based on the literature and the record that has been kept and the proof and the evidence of the presence of what appear to be technologically controlled and manipulated, rather, you know, technologically advanced and intelligently controlled craft, you know, you can't ignore, to me, the UFO enigma. But we don't have proof in terms of what exactly the origins behind this enigma are. And that's what we're trying to understand. And to try and discount that, yes, to me, is a little bit absurd.
Well, I mean, regardless of whether they're extraterrestrial or terrestrial or crypto-terrestrial or subterrestrial, I still want to know whether or not they're capable of raining down fiery gamma-radiated death on us.
That's true, yeah. And, you know, when we had Robert Hastings on the program a couple of months ago, you know, that was one of the only qualms, really, that I had with Robert, was that he thought that, you know, by virtue of what they have done, when I say they, let's be clear here and let's be very concise, I'm talking about UFO craft observed, especially those appearing over government installations, and many of which are armed with nuclear warheads, okay? This is because, and the reason we make that specific distinction is because Robert Hastings' work, the majority of it deals with UFOs seen over government installations, and even often, okay, as outlined in his research, interrupting test flights of missiles, ballistic missiles and warheads and the like. Mr. Hastings, of course, feels like what is going on is probably something that is good. It may be beneficial to humankind because these things are capable of disarming warheads and therefore, you know, mutually assured self-destruction and the like, you know, nuclear holocaust and all these things become less likely in the presence of UFOs. But what I would argue is, if we don't know who is piloting these flying saucers or these humming triangles or whatever the hell all these different kinds of things are, you know, can we really rest our faith in something that remains so clandestine? I certainly, for one, am not very comfortable with that, and therefore I have to suspend my pleasure at knowing that that there are UFOs that are capable of disarming our nuclear weapons. What happens if there were an actual threat posed by some of these craft? That may or may not ever be the case or even a consideration, but if they ever did pose us a threat and then they decided to disarm nuclear weapons and the thing, you know, and similar weaponry, then what are we doing, you know? And the thing is that so many are completely unaware of the literature that even pertains to this sort of thing. The reason that this is treated as a water cooler subject, UFOs in general, is because of the way that the mainstream media treats it. And ever since the 1960s, with the closure of the Air Force's official inquiry into UFOs, that was Project Blue Book. And then, of course, we had the Condon Committee, which was the University of Colorado UFO project overseen by Edward Condon. Their determination that UFOs and their further study didn't present any scientific gains or potential scientific gains, and therefore there was no point in continuing to study the things. These things, these instances, these specific events in history in the 1960s led to the outward dismissal over the next several decades by, I believe, probably the majority of the scientific community. And therefore, what we are left up against is a host of civilian researchers, many of whom, and I don't say this to discredit them, but many of whom are not trained officially in the study of unexplained aerial phenomenon and the varieties of different kinds of atmospheric phenomenon and things like that. Now, there are a lot of people who are investigators, civilian investigators, who are highly trained in various areas of science and other technologies that would assist in trying to better discern what these things are. Again, I'm not trying to make a broad statement, but the point is that many people who witness UFOs and who are out there studying them don't have military backgrounds or scientific backgrounds. I would say the majority of them don't. And therefore, it makes it difficult for those individuals and the information that they bring to the table, myself included, to be taken very seriously by peer-reviewed scientific journals and the like. I read, I think it was Jim Schnabel who wrote the book back in the 1990s, Dark White. I think he wrote on his blog fairly recently that maybe the best thing that civilian UFO researchers can do is to hope to try and get this subject to be taken seriously again so that the mainstream scientific establishment will take it seriously and that they will pay attention to it. Because otherwise, we're never going to be able to get to the bottom of this phenomenon and what may or may not actually be happening. But part of the battle is educating people to the fact that there is data that constitutes a body of knowledge, and I think that that body of knowledge pertaining to UFOs, unidentified flying objects, whatever they may be, you can't deny that there is indeed something going on. But nonetheless, most people to this day, I'd say the majority of Americans and people around the world, are, although they may be aware of UFOs, they may be aware of the idea of aliens or extraterrestrial visitation and all these things that may or may not truly be, I think that people are, for the most part, unaware of the actual body of literature that constitutes proof and evidence for this phenomenon. And based on that, most people, although they even sometimes are interested in it, they'll watch Ancient Aliens and shows like that on television, they still don't take it seriously. And therefore, subjects like Occupy Wall Street do become the focus of the mainstream's attention. And don't get me wrong, that is very important. As a matter of fact, in the next segment of this program, I think we'll seek to address a little bit of that, as well as opening the telephone lines and taking your calls here at the Graylian Report. But I just want to point out that although in the immediate sense, because of the immediacy of the fiscal crisis in this country, and not just in this country, the geoeconomic considerations involved here. In other words, the global economy right now. These are immediate concerns, and when they are immediate concerns that literally could bring crashing down the very society that you and I have grown to know and love, that, my friends, yes, is something that has to take immediate precedence. But we also need a pleasant escape from that from time to time. And while we will touch on world issues and global events here on the Graylian Report, we're also going to keep talking about UFOs and aliens. I'm Micah Hanks. This is your weekly hub for the strange and unusual. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be taking your calls and getting to news when we come back right after this.
Hey parents, introducing the Communicizer. Go from boring old man speak.
Oh, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
I love you, Dad.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency. And 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now, before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
Elijah. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Thank you, John Anderson, one of the many voice talents that we feature here on the Graylian Report each week. And welcome you, my listeners, back to the program. We will be taking your calls live here on the program, 828-398-4886, or live on Skype via our convenient Skype user ID. It's easy to remember, G-R-A-L-I-E-N Report. That's how you can find us on Skype. I also want to send out a really quick thank you to our very good friend Leslie. She's a listener of the program who just made a donation. The continuing 2011 Graylian Report donation drive, well, it is underway, and we do have help and support from wonderful folks like you out there. So, Leslie, our sincerest thanks to you. And we'll keep you updated throughout the program as more donations and other support keep coming in, well, from folks like you. We do appreciate that, and we can't thank you enough. That said, I wanted to jump into a program. Our good buddy over Lon over at Phantoms and Monsters, if you haven't been to the website, let me give you this address. It's a little complex. It's Natural Plane, P-L-A-N-E, naturalplane.blogspot.com. That's going to be Phantoms and Monsters. Here's what the report for Tuesday, October 13th, this was 1 week ago. This is what it read. A photo, second Mothman bat-like object witnessed over Chicago. We didn't get to this one in time to talk about it on the program last week. I'm looking at the photograph, and I tell you, whatever this thing is, it does look like a bat. For all I know, maybe it is a bat. But this thing was photographed over, let's see here, what's the town? I guess this was in the southwest suburbs of Chicago. The person who wrote in said, my wife and me travel into Chicago to take care of some business, and on our way back we took a cruise through my old neighborhood just to check it out and see what had changed. We were going down 63rd Street, going west, and we're coming up to Pulaski Road. And then I remembered about a giant Indian that is on the roof of this tobacco store nearby. That's what it was when I was a kid. It's something else now. Well, on the northwest corner of 63rd and Pulaski Road in Chicago, anyway, there's this large Indian with his hand up in the air. In fact, there's one just like it here in Asheville, North Carolina, up on the hill if you're headed down Patton Avenue. Folks, see that. Also, our field correspondent Tyler Pittman recently this week, very interesting, this is sort of synchronistic, Tyler Pittman posted pictures on his Facebook page this week of a similar giant Indian from someplace down in Georgia. So there, these things are, yeah, exactly, just like that. So these things are popping up all over the place. And that's what's interesting is that actually I had seen Tyler's photos that he posted on his Facebook page just prior to finding this story about Mothman, went to click the link, which we'll have up at graylianreport.com shortly. And there's this Indian standing there with his arm up in the air and this thing that, well, they say looks like Mothman flying right behind it. Now, I'm looking at this photograph. I have an idea, at least, as to what I think it is. And it does look like a very large bat to me, but I know looks can be deceiving. Maybe the bat isn't really that large.
From over here, it kind of looks like it.
It looks like what?
From over here, it kind of looks like a manta ray.
You know what's funny about that, by the way?
I can't see it all. You're, yeah.
See if you can, okay. Can you see that, Matt?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bat.
Okay. This thing, whatever it is, it does look a little bit like a manta ray. There are a lot of reports of flying manta rays, flying jellyfish. Yes.
Dergopal.
Dergopal. Yeah, anybody know about Dergopal? You know, it's funny because I actually investigated a... I didn't personally investigate this, but I learned about this. I think it was a Dutch report of a thing that was seen, and it was called Dergopal. Der Flying Gopal, which is, you know, I mean, a flying jellyfish is what they're referring to in the German language. But this thing, the photograph that accompanied this story of the flying Gopal was quite... enigmatic. It did. It looked like a great big kind of puffy looking, well, jellyfish floating up in the air. And here's this thing hovering along, and I'm thinking, goodness, what is that? And they referred to it as what they called, and this is a terrible translation, unfortunately, that had been generated by Google Translate. It described what was being seen as a Dombski due to heat generation. A Dombski. So I went to a friend of mine who actually speaks the Dutch language, and I asked him, what is a Dombski? And he couldn't tell, and so I tried different variations of the pronunciation. I tried...
couldn't tell or wouldn't tell?
It was a conspiracy. He couldn't, to the best of my understanding, he could not tell what I was trying to describe to him. So I said, Damsky, Damsky. He says, oh, Damsky. Yeah, Damsky, like a cloud. Okay. So he said that this was some sort of a cloud or something like that is what was being described, and that whatever this cloud-like thing was, it had been produced by what this, you know, translation described as heat generation. Come to find out, what had actually happened was that there was a power plant nearby, and that it had large exhaust pipes or whatever, and that these, you know, these pipes would release these great big, you know, kind of, it wasn't smoke actually. What it was just kind of a fog or a mist that, you know, that would come out of these, I guess, and that this one of these big plumes of moisture had come out of one of these pipes, and that someone had photographed it. And sure enough, the thing did look like a great big jellyfish, and it was rather convincing too. But indeed, it was, again, a fairly prosaic explanation behind this this strange appearing or appearance of what many called a flying gopal. So, but nonetheless, the literature is pretty, I wouldn't say rife with, but I would say that there are at least a notable number of instances where in reports of UFOs and things, people have described seeing jellyfish, manta rays, and, well, then there are these bat-like things. And, of course, Mothman, known for his bat-like wings, comes to mind when we're looking at this thing that is up at the Phantoms and Monsters website. We'll get that link up here for you in just a moment. But in other news, you know, we have been watching the Wall Street protests, and before I dive into this, I do want to say maybe something else that we could bring to the discussion tonight, and especially if people want to call in with their thoughts about this. In addition to Occupy Wall Street, which we talked about last week, and you know, and Matt and I, as we've already alluded, you know, we've been talking with some people, you know, people of a nonpartisan persuasion, to try and get some history and some background on the financial crisis and a number of elements that are precipitating the situation in the United States today that has caused the unrest and thus provoked people, you know, and stirred them up enough to where they want to literally camp outside Wall Street, not just in New York. I mean, this is going on in many cities around the country right now. People are protesting, you know, the problems with the banking industry and business and government, all these things that are compounding into the problems that America faces today. It's difficult to try and find one singular cause for all this, but, you know, we've been digging into it. And it's not just Matt and I. You know, Chris and all the other folks here associated with the program, you know, are contributing to this. Let me just tell you, I think we've got 4 staff members right now here at Graylian International, at least. I'm counting at least 4 who are actually on this, working on this right now.
Supplemental to us, of course.
Yes, and so what we're going to try and do is we want to try and put together, you know, a coherent timeline. And I'll just tell you this, and I hate to just drop a teaser, but right now, you know, although Wall Street is what is being protested, as we've already alluded to on the program, I think, in the past, I don't think that the entire thing can be attributed directly and solely to Wall Street. It's always a complex situation, and frankly, I think that the multiple levels of what's the best word? Let's measure our words carefully here. The multiple levels of not just inefficiency on part of these institutions, but I think also, frankly,
treachery.
Yeah, you could. It's close to criminal behavior, I think, that some of the government institutions, you know, and some of the banking industry have been involved in. You know, whether it be Fannie Mae and you know, all these different organizations. Let me just tell you, it's complex. So we're going to hope to try and put together at least a brief report that we will touch on in the coming, probably next week, on the Graylian Report, because, you know, we don't like to dwell on those things. I realize that when people listen to this program, they're getting away from some of the stuff that they're faced with throughout the week, all the serious stuff. You can come here, you can relax, we can talk about some things that challenge our mind and don't just cause us to worry and want to go, you know, dig a hole in the ground or live in a bunker like we have to down here at Graylian International. I realize that people will listen to this program because it's entertaining, but again, though, I do feel, especially with an election year coming up, that we're kind of obligated to look at real-world issues, because without addressing the real-world issues, it may be more difficult in the future for us to continue to provide programs for you like this one. Independent programs that are not overseen by the mainstream media and by political organizations and moneyed interests and things like that. You know, we are an entirely independent operation here at the Graylian Report. We want to continue to be that, and therefore we have to take the things that allow us to, or could potentially disallow us, I don't think disallow is a word, but you know what I'm talking about, the things that could prevent us from being able to provide this program on a weekly basis. We don't want to do that. We want to stay on the airwaves, and we want to do so in good faith and good cheer. And that, my friends, we shall no doubt continue to do. But that said, if you do have thoughts about the Wall Street protest, or the Wall Street occupation, as they prefer to call it, you're welcome to dial into the program at 828-398-4886, and also on Skype at Graylian Report. Another thing that I want to invite people to touch base with us about tonight, should they so choose, is to, you can call in, and actually, if you're observing the presidential debates that are going on right now, you know, I would love to be watching the presidential, well, it's not presidential, but it's, I guess, what you call it, you know, presidential candidate debates, you know. I think they call them presidential debates nonetheless, but they are certainly not presidents that are on that stage. Now, I don't know, one of them, or maybe, you know, a combination of a couple of those will end up running for the office of president and vice president next year. We will see what's going to happen. Inevitably, almost inevitably, one of the individuals who is participating in tonight's debate will be discussing, or rather will eventually be running against our present president. But I do try and follow politics also, because this has a lot to do with the real stuff that we have to focus on from time to time. And therefore, as opposed to us talking about it, what we thought we would do is put that out there. If people are watching the debate or have comments that they'd like to share, well, you're welcome to call in about that here on the program tonight as well. But in the meantime, we're going to move right along and look at a BBC News report that caught my eye. Power from the people. Kind of funny that we mentioned power from the people, because we were talking about these protests and the things that people like you and I can do to get involved right out there, you know, in the real world. What you can do to get involved in you know, civic activity and, you know, freedom of speech and expression and association. But that's not the kind of power to the people we're talking about. No, we're talking about biofuel here. Plugging gadgets into the socket of a wall, or loading them with batteries, or maybe even just unfurling a solar panel. That's how most of us think about getting fuel, electricity. But what about plugging them into your body? What if you could plug your iPhone into you and get energy from... Yeah, I know, now Matt's like laughing. Oh, yes, let's think of a different... Matt, yes. Matt, you're thinking along the lines of...
I think some people do already.
Well, yeah, I think some people might as well already have their iPhones plugged in. And no, we're not talking about, how do I want to say this? We're not talking about convenient bodily orifices that may already be present on the human body, okay? Bear with me, it may sound far-fetched, but according to a recent BBC News report, under the shadow of the Alps, Dr. Serge Koncier and his team at the Joseph Fourier University in Grenoble have built a device that will do just what I'm describing. Their gadget, called a biofuel cell, uses glucose and oxygen at concentrations found in the body, get this, to generate electricity. They're the first group in the world to demonstrate their device working while implanted in a living animal. If all goes according to plan, within a decade or two, they say that biofuel cells may be used to power a range of medical implants, not just iPhones and things like I've described, probably more practically things like medical implants, sensors, and even drug delivery devices.
Blenders,
yes. Well, yeah, so we all want a portable blender that, you know, attaches to our forearm and things like that.
Yeah, because that's only one step away from me getting a usable working USB port plugged into my forearm. I'm all for it.
Well, you know, again, that seems to be the idea. And here's the question I have. They're talking about, what do they say here? They say glucose and oxygen. So what are we dealing with here chemically, okay? Glucose, can I say that glucose is essentially a form of sugar?
Yeah.
Okay, well, now what happens with sugars that aren't broken down in the body? Anybody care to venture to? Okay, let's get away from the metabolic discussion here. Here's what I'm getting at. I'm wondering if, based on the design of these devices, or such a device, is it possible that when a person isn't exercising enough, okay, and excess, we'll say, energy that is brought into the body through consumption, that is stored and thus later will turn into fat? Well, I wonder if a biofuel generator would utilize excess fuel, you know, in fat or sugars or things like that, or carbohydrates, whatever else taken into the body, and could utilize those for powering small devices. And now I'm thinking, again, what they're describing here isn't literally, you know, I'm going to have like a backpack hooked up to me. It's a little, you know, portable Mr. Fusion, and, you know, it's going to be, you know, powered by, well, let's see here. If it's on your back, what would be the most convenient orientation? We could have it gas-powered, I guess. A gas-powered fusion device. We're talking about real live fart fuel here, folks.
No, I just got to wonder, though, and this sounds like a joke, but I'm serious. When I think of how long it takes to charge up my iPod, you know, or my cell phone sometimes, how much could that drain a person, you know?
Well, they get into this...
Like, you know, I'm charging my phone, but now I'm going to take a nap.
Sure. They get into this a little, though. And here's what they're describing. You know, like I said, I wonder if excess fuel, okay, taken into the body when you eat food, you know, which for a lot of people is going to, you know, constitute, you know, well, it's going to contribute probably to the gaining of fat and, you know, because let's just face it, you know, I think that there are a lot of people out there who are in really good shape, but the majority of us probably would like to be a little bit more, you know, toned or a little bit, you know, bigger in all the right areas. You know, Matt, get your mind out of the gutter, you know, putting on muscle and the like, or losing a little here and there. Nobody's perfect, and most people would like to make little improvements here and there, but I just wonder if something like this would be... although it's a little dangerous sounding too, and we start thinking about, you know, supplementing the human body with devices and things like this, could it be beneficial? That's all I'm saying. Now, what they describe here is that biofuel cells may be used to power a range of medical implants, sensors, drug delivery devices, to the or even to entire artificial organs within the human body. And what they say is that all you'll need to do to power them is to eat a candy bar or drink a Coke. So, you know, the fundamental idea here, again, I pointed out that they said that these would use glucose and oxygen. And yes, they're saying that, you know, sugars taken into the body would power these fuel cells. Very interesting. Biofuel cells could kickstart a revolution in artificial organs and prosthetics that would transform tens of thousands of lives on a yearly basis. A new range of artificial electrically powered organs are already apparently under development, too, according to this study. Including hearts, kidneys, and even, get this, a bladder sphincter, a,
work. See, you got to make noises like that, and, you know,
If you're done, I'll go ahead and continue, Matt.
I'm sorry.
Would you put a lid on it?
Like
hey,
that?
Matt, would you put
you're
a lid on
be
it?
Like
Matt,
that?
Would you?
All right.
Would you put a lid on it, Matt? Let's see here. Fingers, even the eyes, but they all have one Achilles heel. They need electricity to run. Matt, what are you doing over there?
Face.
What are you doing over there, boy? Goodness gracious. Folks, we have an immediate opening for an engineer here at Grillion International Headquarters.
That's how it's going to be, huh?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That's how it's going to be.
Wait, you turned his microphone back on.
Yeah.
He turned his microphone back on.
I did.
Yeah, I didn't do anything.
You throw things at me and then you offer my
I didn't throw anything.
You threw it.
I didn't throw anything. Actually, it's the new biomechanically powered arm that's protruding from my back that threw it at you. You see?
Can we just be friends and give each other hugs and do the show?
Yeah, which arm should I hug you with? I've got three now.
I'll take all three.
Yeah.
Ideally, I'm looking for a six-armed hug. If anyone out there has six arms and wants to give me the best hug ever... I'll pay for it.
Hugs are what make the world go around, and we here at Grailian Report, well, we certainly like them, at least when they're coming from the right people. We'd hug you right now if we could, but we have to go pay the bills, unfortunately. I'm Micah Hanks, joined in studio by producer Chris Hayes, and there's somebody else in here. Am I forgetting somebody, Chris? Oh, yeah, Matt. Matt's back there, the Reverend. He's preaching that on the airwaves. Hey, Matt, we need a top 10. What's your top 10 going to be tonight? You can't tell me now. Tell me when we come back from this break. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be back on the Grailian Report right after this.
Bob Harmon from InceptionRadioNetwork.com. I'm going to clue you into the show that I listen to every single week. It's Inception Radio with Jamie Hannigan. It airs Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Jamie always brings on new guests every single week on a variety of topics. UFOs, it's paranormal, it's time travel, conspiracy theory, it's everything. And Jamie covers it in depth. With us again, Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you there.
All right, guys, I know you've been putting it off. Your thirst for knowledge is incredible, insatiable, but your wallet says otherwise. So you haven't been able to subscribe to all those classy magazines out there bringing you to the edges of the fringe just like you and I do every week here on the Grailian Report. Well, good news for you. You can now subscribe to Intrepid Magazine for an entire year and just pay $19.95. Really? That's it? It's no joke. $19.95 will get you an entire year of incredible insight from authors like Nick Redfern, Scotty Roberts, and of course yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Visit www.intrepidmag.com today and feel your mind expanding tomorrow.
Want to have some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
Metaphor was used in religious books, used every day by religious groups to control the minds of those who have read the books. Open up your minds and take a simple look. Imagine Eve or the foolish humans, who did their children procreate with? They say we're born in sin only because of the lie they created. The lie is creation. The book is a metaphor, containing bullshit religious law that the humans wise up to. But now they want to go back and chop their heads. Don't agree with their political opinion in your head. Jesus the magician rebelled against the fiction and still has some messed up books.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and you've locked in. It is the Graylian Report, your light in the darkness, here every Tuesday evening from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Hearing some music there from Shaman and the Wise Men. Some of our listener-contributed music here at the Graylian Report. If you'd like to contribute your own music for consideration here on the program, now we will be picky, but if you'd like to send it along, of course, we always like playing good music here on the program. We featured some tunes by not only our friends here, Shaman and the Wise Men, but also from Paul Workman in the past and a few others. The artists formerly known as Avoca also have been featured on the program and others. You can email Matt Oakley, engineer@graylianreport.com, to pass along music. He's the music man handling all the tunes back there. So back to the program. Yeah, Matt's going to have a top 10. I think what we need to do is it too soon for me to say what? Yeah. I think we should do. Yeah.
I'm still iffy on it.
You're still
I'm
iffy?
Still deciding which one to go with.
That's okay. That's all right.
You know?
Once you figure it out, I'm excited. I just can't wait to see what it is. Anyway, I had a theory about what you were going to do. But let's see. What are we moving on to here? We were talking about this biofuel power from people story. That one's kind of interesting. I don't know. I'd like to know your thoughts on that. If anyone would like to call in, you can reach us here on the program at 828, area code 398-4886. Now, that number is going to bring you right here to the studio. Do keep in mind that most cell phone plans will cover in-country calls with no problem. But just be careful because, some server charges and distance charges and things like that could apply. Just be mindful of that, folks. Otherwise, you're welcome to call into the program, or you can reach us via Skype if you'd like to do that alternatively. Skype calls are typically, at the expense of nothing. And you can reach us at Graylian Report on Skype. You know, there was an interesting story. I follow a website called Slashdot. And Slashdot is a really, really unique website. In fact, it's one of my very favorite ones to get news, that's kind of techie and sci-fi oriented. In fact, I think last week when we talked about this new pre-crime division that the NSA is talking about implementing, which was terrifying to me because, and it's funny, our field correspondent, Anya Briggs, after she got off the program with us, she had been listening to the broadcast following that and literally sent me a text message after the fact and said, this is absolutely terrifying. And what they were talking about was utilizing, now get this, things like, what was it? I think that they were saying skin color and some various other factors that would be helpful in determining certain things about individuals who might be more likely to commit a crime than others. It's getting into the realm of profiling, and it could be a potentially dangerous kind of thing. And frankly, trying to to assume anything about a person before that individual has actually committed a crime is troublesome to me. On a fundamental level, anyway. That said, let's go to the phones. I think we're joined by Mike right now. Mike, are you with us? Hello, Mike. I think we may have lost him, but Mike, if you're back, or if you want to try and call back, we'll get you on the program via Skype there. But that said, I was talking about this this situation with what was the website I was telling you about that had left the. The story we used last week, it was Slashdot. They had this story that was linked up today, Science Fiction's Take on the Future of Computers, Visionaries and Imaginaries. It's interesting that they bring this up because Science Fiction's Take on the Future of Computers reminded me of something we talk about a good bit here on the program, the singularity. Which is, and when I refer to the singularity, there are a lot of different ideas about what singularity actually means. But what we are referring to specifically when I say the singularity is, I think, probably the same thing that most of the transhumanists today and Ray Kurzweil and these types would mean, and that is essentially that when humans kind of merge with technology as our advancement of technology grows and continues to grow over the next several decades at such a rate, when we're talking about the rate at which technology is expanding, here's what I mean. We're actually talking about not only just technology growing and getting, you know, more and more comprehensive and elaborate over time, we're talking about an exponential growth. I think Kurzweil in his book, The Singularity Is Near, actually described it like this. He says, you know, it's kind of like planting a lily pad or two in your pond, hoping that there are going to be a few. And, you know, in a couple of days, you don't see a whole lot of lily pad growth. You leave your home, you go to the beach for a week, you come back, and all of a sudden your pond is covered in lily pads. And it's like, what gives? How did they just all spring up overnight? And here's why. You've got one or two lily pads, and each one creates a little lily pad. And then each one of those might create a lily pad, not a whole lot going on. But by the time you've got about 10 lily pads, and each of those are creating small lily pads, you've got 20. Each of those 20 creates a new one. You see, your lily pad growth has doubled, and then each of those 40 will create one. And, of course, you know, you see that you compound upon, you know, themselves, and boom, you've got less actual water space and more lily pad coverage on your pond. And the reason I bring up that analogy is that that's the same that Ray Kurzweil used for the way that technology is growing. Not only is technology increasing and improving and expanding, but it is growing in such a way that it is growing exponentially. Now, Kurzweil's not the only one who said this. There have been many who have said this. Jacques Vallée, the famous computer scientist and arguably one of the world's greatest ufologists, has also said this. And I bring these individuals up and the notion of a singularity because later in the program, when we are doing our Mac Tony's tribute, we're going to be touching on this a good bit. We're going to be touching on the notions of singularity, post-singularity humans. In other words, if humans transcend biology and merge with data systems and computers, what I'm wondering is, what will humans be like? What will future humans be like? I can go ahead and tell you this. I have an idea as to what they will be like. Future humans, I'm not going to articulate it right now. I'm going to allow our guest during the third hour to do this, but I'll tell you what he calls them, because I think our guest, Dr. Maxim Kammerer, during the last hour, does a far more eloquent job describing what he calls Homo Mechanicus than I would probably do for you now. I've probably dropped that expression once or twice before in the past on the program. You're going to get a primer in Homo Mechanicus, what potential humans of the future could be like. But now here's the interesting thing, and this is where we get into a little discussion in studio here, guys. You know, I've talked about the singularity. There are divided factions, okay, in terms of cultural ideological interpretations of singularity. Some would liken literally becoming partially mechanized, you know, kept alive by little swarms of nanorobots and things like that and the like. A lot of people really don't find that very appealing. A lot of people say, you know, I like my biological self. I don't like the idea of, oh, Matt's got his hand up in the air.
I don't like that idea.
Well, yeah, you know, I do, and that's why I want to talk to you about it for a minute. We've only got a couple of minutes here at the left in this hour, but I do want to say that it is troubling for a lot of people, the notion that we might in the future be different from how we are right now. So different that we may not really be human. And
Chris's argument, by the way, here in a moment will be, what, you don't want to shoot laser beams out of your eyes?
No. I never said anything about shooting laser beams out of my eyes. I just think it would be really awesome to be able to turn my hand into a gun. Huge difference. No eyes. But anyway, Matt, the thing is, being composed entirely of nanobots, or even partially of nanobots, wouldn't make you any less human, because being human, the only thing that makes you human is the fact that you are the whole of your experiences.
Well, see,
if you were to have your arms and legs chopped off, mm-hmm. you have no arms and legs, and you get prosthetic limbs that are robotic, would you cease to be human?
Okay, see, I see what you're saying there. I don't think you would cease to be human. Now, if your entire physicality is replaced, or let's say your consciousness leaves a physical body and enters a computer system, then are you still human?
As long as you're still in control of your consciousness, yes.
So what is humanity and what is human? See, that's the thing, is it gets into a kind of nebulous area, you know. Is humanity our consciousness? Is it the conscious entity that is inside the cranium? Or is it the physical body? Or is it both? I mean, it's a really interesting debate.
And I've got to say, I know I've brought this up, and I think Chris, or I know Chris doesn't agree with this in the slightest, but the thing is the loss of, like, even if it's just mental, the loss of mortality is totally destructive to human nature.
You don't want to live forever, Matt.
I don't.
You don't.
Not at all.
You don't want to have the opportunity to learn absolutely everything, to experience literally everything that is possible. You'd rather just live your 70 years and go ahead and kick the bucket?
Yep.
That is ridiculous. It's ridiculous, Matt. I'm sorry.
It's not ridiculous.
I mean,
I would
never force the nanobot revolution on you, but I don't know, man. The fact that you wouldn't be willing to even take an extra 50 years. You know, you can off yourself at any time, even if you're a robot, even if you're made of nanobots. You can off yourself, or you can set a little, you know, self-destruct that simulates death or whatever. You can end your existence one way or another. You wouldn't take an extra 50 or 100 years to do all sorts of cool stuff.
You know, the way that the studio's oriented, by the way, you know what we need to do? I need to have a mirror right there so that you can look at Matt when you're talking to him.
No, I don't want that. I think you get one shot. You get, you know, your years on Earth. If I abuse habits, then I get less time.
Or if you're like Ray Kurzweil, you know, you take all these supplements and things and you don't age, but like, you know, 2 years every decade or so, you know, right. He's going to live for like 125 years, or 155 years, whatever.
But the thing is your life is dependent on the choices you make.
So does that mean you're not going to take any sort of medicine or medical help to extend your life? You know, if you're dying of cancer.
When was the last time you saw me go to the doctor?
No, if you're dying of cancer, are you going to refuse chemo treatments or radiation treatments to prolong your life? Because, well, yeah, you got cancer, so the natural, you know, span of your life is going to be cut short by like 20 years if you get terminal cancer. But then that becomes the natural span of your life because the cancer happened. Are you going to fix that and get your extra 20 years
back? Let me say this. This is something else that they talk about in the singularity, too, is that, you know, a lot of people, like Ray Kurzweil, for instance, you know, in the what was the documentary made about him? Was it Transcendental Man? Transcendental Man, I think is what it's called. I think it's Transcendental Man. But anyway, now, Matt, hold on. We're going to come back to you, man. Hang on. What I'm saying, though, is that the gentleman says that what he hopes to do, Ray Kurzweil, is to literally use future technology to bring his father back to life in some state. But see, I argue if his father is already dead right now, and if they weren't able to back up, so to speak, like some people say in a post-singularity world we'll be able to do, they say we'll back up consciousness, back up our brains, back up our existence and our memories and our experiences, and that'll all be stored on a computer. If you haven't had that backed up, I mean, how do you tap into the ether or whatever it is and back up a person who's already deceased, you know?
And I just think, you know, even supplemental to that, like, there are so many things that we don't factor into this. I know,
well, I agree.
Chris,
I do agree.
You don't feel this is a viable argument at all, but say somebody creates a computer program or nanobots, which are run by software and computer programs, right?
Sure.
Programming. Somebody creates a program to better everyone. They now have the power to do whatever they want.
No, they don't.
Let me finish. No,
all right,
let the man finish.
Let the Reverend talk.
Even with artificial intelligence.
Matt, sorry, I got to cut you off. You know what? The hour's caught us. You know what? I'm sorry. I'm not just trying to be cruel. Yes, we are out of time this hour. But when we come back, you know, this is something that we never really take time to really dig into. So when we come back on the Grayling Report, we're going to spend as much of hour two as we feel like talking about the singularity. I kid you not. You know, to hell with news stories. No, to hell with news stories. This is something that we need to talk about. We need to get into this. I'm Micah Hanks, and we're going to dig real deep into the singularity when I come back right after this on the Grayling Report. Stay tuned.
This is the sound of a flat-screen television hurled off a building. Now the new bike your kid wants. These are the things you could have, all cast into oblivion. Because when you throw away money on wasted electricity, you throw away everything you could have bought with it. Use Energy Star light bulbs and appliances, and you could save hundreds of dollars a year. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
It takes 12 years to create a graduate. It takes about the same time to create a dropout. And at the end of the day, the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be you. So United Way is asking you to make a pledge. Tutor a child who needs help. Mentor a kid who needs someone on their side. Volunteer to read to children. Because when a child advances, we all advance. Be a reader. Tutor or mentor. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge now at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome to Hour 2 of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, joined in studio by our fantastic producer, Mr. Chris Hayes, and the engineer pushing all the right buttons back there on the Master Graylian console, Mr. Matt, the Reverend Oakley. He's going to keep be pushing those buttons for a very long time because he's not going to allow nanorobotic fodlets into his body. You know, they're going to, make him a post-singularity homo mechanicus. Isn't that right? Am I interpreting this correctly?
Exactly.
You see, you're not.
And you've pitted Chris and I against each other this discussion.
You just do the show, okay? You do your show. I'm not pitting anybody against anybody, but I am saying that I think that, and again, if you don't know what a foglet is, I'm probably not best equipped to describe this notion to you. I'll tell you who'd be good to talk about it is my younger brother. I do have good news. We're about to be joined by a personal friend of Mac Tony's because we are tonight on the program during Hour 3, and that's part of the reason we're discussing the singularity right now. During Hour 3, we are going to be discussing with Dr. Maxim Kammerer the singularity and what the singularity has to do with all this, Mac Tony's and some of his very innovative thinking with regard to transhumanism and UFOs. Mac Tony's was kind of an inspiration, really. He was a very brilliant guy. I'd just begun to get to know him when he died rather suddenly 2 years ago today. Today actually marks the anniversary of Mac's passing from this realm, and that's why we're going to do a commercial-free special third hour tonight on the Graylian Report that discusses the work of Mac Tony's and, his life and his kind of vision of the future. Part of that involved what some call the singularity. But I do want to say, before we get to that, because that's hour three and it will be brought to you commercial-free, an interview with Dr. Maxim Kammerer. We'll be discussing the work of Mac Tony's. During this hour, we have a very special treat for you because a good friend of mine with a Hidden Experience blog. I've been on his program before, and he's a personal friend of Mac Tony's, Mr. Mike Cleland. He joins us live right now on the Graylian Report. Mike, are you with us?
I am with you. How do I sound?
You sound fantastic. And, Bud, thank you so much for calling in. It's a rare treat that that you and I get to chat as it is. Our schedules are both so up and down, but, you knew Mac personally, and you happened to be out there tonight, and I got this email from you. You were like, man, you're doing a Mac Tony's show. Hey, can I jump on and chat for a while? And so, in the midst of this crazy conversation, it is our pleasure to welcome you to the Graylian Report and, of course, invite you to the conversation. So welcome.
Thank you so much.
Excellent. Now, you knew Mac personally, and you had some experiences, after Mac's passing from this realm, that were rather strange and interesting. So, if it's okay with you, I'll go ahead and kind of give you the floor and let you tell us a little bit about some of that.
I never met Mac personally, but we did talk on the phone a fair amount, and we became quite close. I did the illustrations for his book titled The Crypto-Terrestrials, which was published shortly after his death, and you know, I was actually sort of working on those at the time that he died. So, you know, there was some back and forth going on with that, as well as a lot of late night phone calls that we would have, mostly focused on the UFO phenomena that we were both, you know, fascinated by. And he was extremely insightful as far as his ability to, you know, take complicated ideas and then, you know, jumble them around in his head and then come up with something that sounded just so great and so insightful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mech was just incredible. And by the way, we've got a copy of the Cryptoterrestrials here in studio, and I was showing the guys some of your artwork. I did neglect to mention that you actually were the artist, you know, who provided fantastic illustrations for this book, and I think that that's just so cool that in addition to a personal friend of Mac's on the program, we also have the gentleman, the very talented artist who illustrated his final testament of sorts. So, you know, Mac, he was so neat. And like I said, you know, Mike, you knew him even better than I did, but I was always so fascinated with his theories about things, not just cryptoterrestrials. He talked about a matrix-like reality and all these different kinds of things. You know, what was it about Mac that attracted you to his work?
The very first time I heard of Mac was when I heard him interviewed on Banal of America, Tim Banal's show, and that would have been in, I think, like March of 2007.
Yeah.
So I heard him, and it was funny, like almost without, I listened to the show and I realized like I have to talk to this guy, so I just dialed him up. I, you know, looked up his phone number in the phone book in Kansas City, Missouri, and then you know, basically left a message on his machine. And a few hours later, he returned a call, and without really skipping a beat, we just got right into it and just started talking You know, we continued to have phone calls like that, you know, for the next couple of years.
That's interesting, because in this information age that we live in today, you know, most people are, you know, either doing email or Facebook or something like that. Now, you and I, of course, you know, we got acquainted. I remember you and I were very much like that. I can totally imagine, you know, Mac just falling into a conversation with you, because I remember you invited me on your podcast, and I guess this is just within the last year, and you know, that conversation started like, okay, we've talked for 30 minutes, we should probably start the interview. And then, you know, we kept going and going and going, talking about coffee, everything, you know, owls. So, you know, you're very easy to talk to, and of course, you know, you and I kind of hit it off like that. Mac definitely seemed to have that kind of attitude. He seemed very approachable, very warm, very friendly. And you know, he I don't think he was one of those investigators who, you know, people in the community really, really respected him and what he did. But he hadn't quite crested the wave into, you know, real full-blown, you know, widespread notoriety. And that's so neat that he had the time and was willing to take the time, of course, you know, to make phone calls to people and just stay in touch with folks, you know, like yourself and like me and you know, share his ideas. The exchange of ideas seemed to be very important to him, especially as evidenced by the kind of things he put up on his blog, Post-Human Blues. You know, Mike, do you know anything about the website? I've wondered about that, and I actually... I'll probably ask our guest next hour the same thing with regard to the website, you know, especially if you don't know the answer. I hope his website, Max, will stay online, Post-Human Blues, but I don't know what the situation is with that, since he's, you know, no longer able to moderate it himself.
You know, I have no idea, and I know that there's been an effort made by some people just to make sure that it stays up. You know, like, for instance, no one knows what the password is.
Right.
And I have no idea, like, you know, within the workings of what would be, you know, Blogger, his blog site, whether they – and I know people have contacted them and basically said to keep that online. There was quite a good article in the New York Times Magazine on, you know, sort of the posthumous – presence that people, individuals can have on the web. And there was a big section on Mac, which was quite well written. And
New York Times Magazine.
Because given that it was New York Times, they kind of dismissed the UFO thing. They kind of brushed that under the table and didn't even bring it up.
Sure. That's interesting, though. I didn't know that that he'd been featured in New York Times Magazine. And they were primarily focusing on the fact that this was, I guess, what you'd call, you know, with all due respect, blogging from beyond the grave.
Yeah, well, his presence remains online, even though he's you know, now gone. So, you know, that blog, which I don't know how many years it would have been, probably 4 or 5 years of almost daily postings. So that's all still up there and accessible. It's posthumanblues.blogspot.com, and it's great. And periodically I'll just go on there and just – you know, poke around. I mean, there's such a wealth of stuff, and it's pretty easy to just to you know, click on things, and it's, he's had a great sense of humor, and the stuff he was digging into and the stuff he would find on the internet was amazing. So that you know, that was the focus of the New York Times article, which I was you know, pretty impressed. I mean, they focused mostly on him, and I think there were three people in total, him and two other people, and it seemed like the meat of the article was on him, because since his passing, there was a handful of Mac Tony's commemorative or memorial sites.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That people are keeping.
Entirely deserved also. You know, I mean, I remember the morning that I found out. I think I found out through probably Nick Redfern. And, you know, I've been emailing back and forth with him. And also the publisher, Patrick Wiege. And I remember we were all so sad. But the other thing, too, especially in the days that followed, that was on Patrick's mind and a few others was, you know, he has this manuscript. And, you know, we've got to try and get that manuscript and get that published. You know, it can't just, it can't languish, you know, or be lost on his computer. And thankfully, Mac's mother, as a matter of fact, actually, if I may, I'll just read from the publisher's, you know, forward sort of here, the editor's note in the Cryptoterrestrials that was written by Patrick Wiege. He said, Mac Tony's died in his sleep on the evening of October 18th, 2009, at the age of 34. He was weeks away from turning in his manuscript on the Cryptoterrestrials, the book I'm now reading to you from as we speak. With the help of his family and friends, we've been able to piece together this, his final book. In particular, I'd like to thank his mother, Dana Tonies, for rescuing the hard copy of the manuscript he had left on his desk and had been working on. And then he goes on to name several other people. In fact, Patrick says Mike Cleland, who contributed the wonderful interior art. And, of course, that is you, sir, and we do thank you very much for that. In addition to, you know, knowing Mac and having spoken with him a good bit, you know, you've mentioned that you have some paranormal stories that occurred after his death. Did you want to delve into those?
Sure. These are, you know, here I'll give you a couple. One is, so I had the manuscript sent to me through Patrick Wiege, and he sent it electronically, so I had it as a PDF. So what I did is I went to the, and this was in the months after he died, and I went to the Xerox shop in town and got it printed up on three-hole punch paper and put it in a three-ring binder. And then I knew I had to read it, and I had to make some notes. And we had talked about a few things that he wanted. And one of the things we talked about was that we wanted it to look like R. Crumb. And, you know, the illustrations from R. Crumb, we both agreed that we were huge fans of R. Crumb. And so when I actually did the illustrations, I very much kept that in mind and tried to do the illustrations in kind of a R. Crumb influenced style, not so much the you know, there's no you know, big legged women, but there is
or
a lot
Sasquatches.
Of black ink in the text, excuse me, in the illustrations, and you know, a lot of, you know, heavy dark shadows, which is something that R. Crumb does when he does pen and ink illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
But so I knew I had to go through and read the script, the text, and I was putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, and finally there was a day when I realized, like, okay, I can't put this off anymore. It was actually kind of an emotional thing to you know, to confront this text. So you know, I was pretty broken up by when I heard the news. So what I did was did a little formal thing. I made a cup of tea. I set the text on the coffee table. I put my reading glasses on. I turned all the music, you know, like there was no sound in the house. And I had a red pen that I could make some notes on the margin of the text with. And then I opened up the three-ring binder. And I read the very first line. And then there was an audible clunk noise in the room.
Oh.
And my CD player, which had been off, and actually which I had thought was broken, had like ejected a cartridge. You know, it was one of those CD players where you have a cartridge and you stick a stack of CDs in there and then you plug that into the mm-hmm. to the CD player.
Right.
And that chose that moment. Like as I was reading, I read, you know, the Cryptoterrestrials by Mac Tonies, the very first, you know, printed page. And then and at that second, I had that audible noise. And I think it was actually a Red Pill Junkie who commented when I posted that on my blog that, you know, that was actually using a laser beam, that story. I mean, excuse me, that the it was basically the closest laser beam to me in the room. And it was that appliance that managed to make that noise. Now, this all may seem very dismissible in a way, but I'll tell you that my DVD or CD player has never made that noise before. It has never just automatically ejected something like that. And And I took it very seriously. You know, it seemed to me that you know, I needed to pay attention.
You know, Mike, to me, I think that's remarkable. And primarily this is because, you know, I think sometimes what, you know, you and I have had conversations, the conversation about synchronicity, you know, and in fact, I remember the first time I came on your show, you know, you'd said, have you ever had anything strange happen in your life? And I thought, you know, not really. And then I said, you know, when you asked about synchronicity, oh, that happens all the time. And he says, wait a minute, whoa, you say you've never had anything strange happen, and yet synchronicity occurs all the time. I mean, explain that one. And that's the thing is that, you know, I think that synchronicity, which I don't have the definition handy, but, you know, Carl Jung's definition of synchronicity is essentially, you know, events that seem to be, you know, causally related in some way, shape, or form. You know, they're often symbolic in nature. These kinds of coincidences and things, first of all, I don't like calling them coincidences. I don't believe that there are coincidences. And I think that the synchronicity and the meaning behind it often is entirely relevant to the observer. It may not mean anything to someone else. So you're right, it is easy to dismiss, you know, peripherally a story like that. But the thing is that the experience that you had, that if I borrow the, you know, if I may borrow the title of your blog, The Hidden Experience there, is such that, you know, this was of meaning to you. And of course, it had direct relevance, you know, to Mac Tony's and the fact that you were sitting there reading his manuscript as that happened. I think that's beautiful and entirely cosmic, you know, and very much like like Mac, you know, if he had any hand in what may have actually caused that to happen, which he likely did.
And it's interesting. I mean, I have to say that that's my sense. I have no proof of it. I have no way to defend it or to back it up or anything like that. But it's just a gut sense I have. And I feel good about trusting that kind of gut sense.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. That's the thing about synchronicity is that I think we're all kind of learning in this life. You know, we're all going through life hoping to try and, you know, better ourselves and understand things as we go along. And whether you call it intuition or a psychic ability or just trusting your gut, you know, when you feel that little pulling, you know, I've learned in my experience certainly to trust that, to follow it. You know, as New Page Books very, you know, kindly quoted me on their Twitter feed the other day, they quoted this famous thing, it's becoming famous at least, you know, that I've said, and that is that, you know, when you're on the right path in this universe, if you're on the right path in this world, the universe has a way of letting you know, and that was one of those little calling cards, I believe. You know, Mike, we've got to take a short break. Could you stick with us through the break?
Sure can.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I'd love to continue the conversation here on the other side because I suspect you may have a couple more stories. When we come back from this break, we will continue our conversation with Mike Cleland. He was the illustrator of Mac Tony's The Crypto-Terrestrials, and of course, he's also a good friend of Mac's and, well, a good friend of the Graylian Report just as well. We're very glad to have him here on the program discussing the life and work of Mac Tony's. We're going to get a little bit more into that and also, you know, the singularity and some of these conversations that we've been meaning to have here on the program that are so very directly relevant to the work of Mac Tony's. He's a fantastic guy. We love, well, digging into this sort of stuff regardless. So we're going to do it here on the Graylian Report. Right after this, I'm Micah Hanks. Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report here. I just wanted to take a minute, well, really just 30 seconds, to tell you a little about a wonderful project I'm privileged to be a part of these days. It's called Intrepid Magazine. Intrepid is an eclectic melting pot of a variety of different areas of interest, ranging from politics and fringe science to mysteries of the unexplained. You'll hear from authors like Nick Redfern, April Slaughter, Marie D. Jones, and Larry Flaxman, editor and publisher Scotty Roberts, and, of course, yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Period. Subscribe today. Visit www.intrepidmag.com.
from the high mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
That's right, we're your right and reason in an unreasonable world. I'm Micah Hanks, joined by the fantastic production studio staff of Chris Hayes and the Reverend Matt Oakley. We are the Graylian Report, your weekly hub for the strange, the unusual, exopolitics and anomalies from well beyond the fringe. Broadcasting from our dark little corner of the hollow earth to you on a weekly basis every week from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time here on the web. And of course, the downloadable podcast comes later. And we rely on, well, wonderful listeners like you to help us continue to provide this. So your comments, considerations, donations, all that is always well anticipated. It's also much appreciated here on the program. We're joined right now by another person we appreciate a lot, Mr. Mike Cleland, who was a good friend of Mac Tony's. He was also the illustrator of Mac's final book, The Crypto Terrestrials. And we've been discussing some of the paranormal stories that Mike experienced following Mac's passage. So if you're just joining the program, we heard a really interesting one. Mike, do you have, I take it there probably are a few others.
A few, once again, they resonate very strongly to me. I don't know if your listening audience will think them as interesting as I do, but they did resonate very strongly with me. One of the things that happened, Mac and I both wrote a story before I had ever even heard of him, and he wrote it as a short essay, and I think it's actually the opening essay of the Crypto Terrestrials book. It's about a cat and a laser pointer. And I had written almost the exact same essay before ever meeting Mac, and mine was, instead of using a laser pointer, you know how you can use a laser pointer and play with a cat,
oh, yeah,
and the cat chases the laser pointer. It like chases, basically the cat is chasing the little red dot on the carpet or on the wall. And the cat is mesmerized by the little dot, not realizing that that dot is then connected to something, you know, that it's not looking at. It's not paying attention to the little laser pointer in your hand. It's paying attention to the dot on the wall. And the cat gets all amped up. The cat, achieved its sort of catness through the interaction with this odd little red dot. And that was a perfect analogy for the UFO phenomena, where, you know, we look at the metal flying saucer in the sky, and then we extrapolate and say, oh, it's there from Zeta Reticuli, or, you know, it must be aliens from another universe. And but, you know, what is, you know, we are at a loss to know what's really going on. You know, what is, you know, where's the hand that's controlling the laser pointer? And are we just cats, you know, in essence? We have some sort of instinct that likes that paranormal phenomena. So both him and I wrote it where it took place, where it was a cat and playing with a string. And I have to say that I wrote it in a sort of a frenzy one morning. And, you know, just sort of came out of nowhere. I just assumed it was, you know, coffee-influenced creativity. And then some years later, I guess I wrote it in – actually, I have since – some of the last few emails that went back and forth between Mac and I was when we were trying to figure out when we actually wrote that. And I – both he and I wrote it in November of 2006. And I had never heard of Mactonias until March of 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So and those I've posted both those stories on my blog and compared them side by side, and it's very that struck me as extremely curious, and Mac even thought that was very weird also. Then that once again strikes taps into the laser that was the CD player that popped out of its little cartridge, mm-hmm, near me as I was reading the open lines to his book.
It is interesting, though, because, there's the laser reference. Yeah, wow. I have to say, though, that you'd both come to that same, the use of that same metaphor. And at that time, you know, if I'm understanding the lineage of the origin of that story, that you didn't know one another at that time. I mean, that is indeed very interesting. And that's the thing is that we were talking about the singularity at the end of the last hour. You know, I don't know, Mike, your ideas about the singularity. I don't think we ever talked about it. I know it's something that, you know, Mac has touched on a good bit. And our guest next hour, Dr. Maxim Kammerer, who I've, you know, corresponded with a good bit personally, he and I have gone back and forth about this for a long time, that a lot of the time it seems that some of these coincidental little instances that seem to be based, you know, at least in part, intuition and precognition even, and things like that, maybe what I like to call reflections of something that we will be able to perceive about the future, you know. For instance, the laser and the significance of the laser analogy, the fact that both of you would come to use that before knowing one another, and then, you know, after Mac's passage, you know, then the laser, which Red Pill Junkie, who I believe is in our chat room right now, pointed out. That is, you know, I don't think, again, that there are coincidences. I'm one personally that believes that, you know, there is probably some sort of cosmic meaning behind all these kinds of things. And when you think about things on a quantum level, and the strange interrelationship between, you know, I mean, we talk about spooky action at a distance and things like this, you know. Indeed, it seems that all things on a quantum level are interrelated and do have a tendency to be able to influence one another. So, you know, I think that's entirely fascinating that, you know, you, part of your experience in knowing Mac Tonies had everything to do with those kinds of strange interactions.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and that was one of the stuff we talked about late at night, was exactly that kind of stuff.
That's interesting that he was so into that. But now I have to ask you also, Mike, you know, what are your thoughts on the singularity, or do you have an opinion on that notion of humans merging with biology in the next couple of decades?
Well, I mean, it's certainly an interesting subject. You know, one of the things that would stall that out is if, you know, there was some sort of global event that thrust us back into, you know, I don't want to say the Stone Age, but back into the horse and buggy age. So, you know, barring that, you know, they're very the singularity, I guess, is in essence portrayed in 2001, where Hal, that you know, reaches a level of sentience where, you know, the interaction between the you know, the astronauts on board the craft heading out towards Jupiter, mm-hmm, is you know, they are dealing not with a robot, not with a computer. They are dealing with for all, you know, their for all intensive purposes, something that's you know, that has to be recognized as human.
Yeah.
So, you know, that to me sort of is the singularity. And then I think, and now I'm going to paraphrase something that Richard Dolan said, mm-hmm, which I thought was very interesting. So, you know, just imagine the computers, and we just look down the timeline just a little bit. Doesn't take much. Seeing if we look backwards in the timeline, there was no such thing as computers just a short time ago. And then we, you know, look forward, and they change exponentially. You know, what happens on the day that we can sit with our little laptop that's connected up to, you know, the internet, which, you know, it, you know, would also have, you know, those quantum leaps, and you, you know, so your little desktop computer, your little laptop can, you know, make trillions of computations per second, and then have the artificial intelligence to rationally, you know, go through and use those computing skills very much the way a human mind would, and then have access to pull, you know, zillions of documents and data points off of a World Wide Web of information. You know, what happens when you get up and you say, you know, good morning, computer, and the computer, you know, it replies back, you know, good morning, Micah, and then you say, you know, hey, here's a question for you, and the computer says, shoot, you know, I'm ready, and then you say, you know, what's the reality of UFOs? And the computer just instantly goes through all that data, and then it would give an answer that would be hard to you know, deny. You know, what happens when legal trials are you know, sort of take place in that computer realm? You know, what happens when you ask the computer, is there God? And then it shifts through, you know, zillions of computations and capable of looking at the writings of mathematicians and theologians and mystics, and then, you know, coming up with an answer that is achieved through some sort of wisdom rather than just intellect.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a probability. You know, it can look at the probability of all available data in an information system, including the summation of human knowledge, which is migrated over into that grand intangible data cloud that we call the internet, and it can source from that information available to it probability-oriented answers that in all likelihood are probably going to be better than a determination that a human like you or I could come to. We are computers also, but we don't have access and the ability to do that search engine function like a computer would. And that is interesting to me. Now, Mike, something else that's interesting is you're talking about waking up and saying, good morning, computer. Someone brought it to my attention. I either was told this by someone or read it. That if what happens when you want to shut down the computer and the computer says, but don't shut me down, I'll be lonely. And the computers can feel those kinds of things too. Many people say that these sorts of self-aware functions, you know, when computers are able to become self-aware and take on human emotions and senses and feelings and things like this, that, you know, this is what's going to directly precede us literally merging with technology in that way. And that it will actually even go further than how, you know, saying I'm lonely or, you know, I can't allow you to shut me off or, you know, compromise this mission. And so I'm going to think independently and act independently, whether you like it or not. You know, it could get even stranger than that. And that in itself is interesting. And actually, right now, I'm looking at the telecoms website right now. This story from yesterday reads, future phones, get this, may rewire and reinvent themselves utilizing nanotechnology. So, I mean, you know, we're already seeing the beginnings of this sort of technology right now. You think it's right around the corner? And if it comes and happens in the way that we're discussing right now, is it going to be good or bad?
Yeah. I mean, that's like it's a double-edged sword. You know, you're talking to someone who spends a lot of time in the mountains with as minimal of gear as I can take, from my own sense of deep peace. So, you know, like I love having a fast from the technology. I love being away from it. I love being in a natural environment. And I think that there's people right now that have withdrawals. You know, like you take someone's I work for an outdoor school where I take people into the mountains for up to 30 days at a time, and oftentimes young college age folks. And so you enter the mountains, you turn your back on the road, you walk into the wilderness, you live in a very small community of, you know, about 12 to 15 people. It's really a rewarding situation. The thing that you see is initially people have withdrawals the same way as if they were withdrawing from nicotine or if they were withdrawing from, any other drug or any other addictive, you know, act or substance, where they don't have music, they don't have a cell phone, they don't have access to the internet. It's a shocking and very interesting human phenomena, and it, you know, it eventually goes away, and then and almost universally everyone, you know, comes to terms with it and drinks in the natural environment that they're in. But I don't know whether the further down the road we get, will we have a subculture of people who, you know, want to live in primitive societies. I mean, I just think that want to turn their back on this electronic, mechanized, wired at all times society that we live in.
You know what I think it is, Mike? If we do, in Ray Kurzweil and some of the transhumanists, you know, Mac Tony's even considered himself, you know, a transhumanist in that sense. Many of them say that by around the year 2029, we're going to begin to either see the beginning. I think, what Kurzweil calls this is the knee of the curve of the singularity. If this indeed does happen in the next couple of decades, what I think a singularity event like that might bring about, and we were talking about this, you know, the engineer of the program here, Matt, you know, is probably of the three of us here present in the studio the most uncomfortable with the idea of our biology merging with data systems. But the thing is that I think, if anything, as opposed to it being like this technological takeover where everyone, you know, becomes, you know, Homo Mechanicus and we're all robots wandering around and things like that, I think what it may represent is a point of, you know, divergence, you know, in an evolutionary sense, where some people are going to begin to evolve differently because of their acceptance of, you know, this kind of technology. And then others who would prefer to maintain their biology, you know, may remain as such. And therefore, there very well may be a point on, you know, planet Earth in the future where we have both a, you know, Homo sapien, you know, a human like you or I, and then this Homo Mechanicus, something that's entirely different but similar. And, of course, you know, our evolutionary history shows that, you know, we were at one time the same sort of thing. That's kind of an interesting concept, but I wonder if there will be a divergent point where some people will say yay and the others will say, you know what, I'm going up the mountains. I don't want to have a part of this.
You know, I mean, that seems like – it almost sounds like we're writing the, you know, like in a script writing session for a, you know, like a science fiction movie, because, you know, the tensions between those two, you know, could be prove very profound.
Oh, certainly. And you know, something else, too, real quick. Before we'll have to take another break here in a moment, but before we let you go, I wanted to ask you something else, and this isn't entirely related to the singularity, but you brought it up during the discussion. Barring some sort of an event that could, you know, literally take down, you know, our technological infrastructure. You know, I have to assume that you might be referring to something along the lines of electromagnetic pulse weaponry. You know, this is by many considered one of the greatest threats, not only to infrastructure, but also to the way of life on the world as we know it today. Although nuclear weapons can be very destructive and have, you know, tremendous, you know, potential in terms of destruction and you know, of course, you know, endangering our continuance as a species, you know, both in terms of our technological progression and even, you know, our existence here on planet Earth, I think arguably what may be more dangerous than a nuclear weapon in its immediate effects are the other potentials involved in their use. Specifically, if a nuclear weapon is launched high into space and then the resounding electromagnetic pulse shockwave coming down toward Earth, you know, that these EMP weapons of this sort have been described as, you know, I think by not just author William R. Forstchen, who wrote the book One Second After, a fiction novel about this sort of scenario. He spoke before Congress. It's not only been described as one of the greatest threats to American infrastructure and the way of life and living that we know in this country today, but a lot of people say it's a direct threat to our future as humans. So, you know, as a person, you know, who spends a lot of time camping, you know, and does survival training. You've even written books about that. You know, I know that's the other aspect of your life in addition to your interest in the strange and unusual. You know, what are your thoughts on EMP and things like that that could literally stunt our technological progression as a species?
Well, I mean, as far as like just the, you know, the EMP thing is, you know, would compromise the world's electronic systems. I mean, you know, that from the power lines to the telephones to the, you know, to everything.
And cars even, becomes, yeah.
Yeah, we have become so completely dependent on it. You know, I don't know whether it's a mechanized, you know, weapon that, you know, from a satellite, or whether it's just a solar flare, or, mm-hmm. You know, who knows, you know, what could happen. But, you know, trying to predict the future is, you know, almost impossible. But, obviously, if the electronic systems went down, you know, a lot would happen, and it could be very bad. I'm just thinking of the way our society is set up. We're no longer set up as an agrarian society. We're set up as a society that basically goes to the grocery store, and we have you know, mechanized agricultural systems that are, you know, way, way, way out from any urban area. So, you know, just something as simple as that, you know, what happens when the, you know, the gas pumps don't work?
Yeah, people don't know how to hunt. They don't know how to gather food, and what food we do store, you know, it has to remain frozen. If we don't have electricity to keep our, you know, our refrigerators and our freezers running, then what happens when that food is no longer, you know, kept cold? It goes bad. You know, I mean, in Forstchen's book, let me just put it to you bluntly, you know, people end up eating each other. You know, I mean, it's a real nightmare scenario. And I know Bill Forstchen personally. That book's a New York Times seller, but I actually had a chance to talk to him about that just a few months ago. And I told him, I said, Bill, you know, that's my nightmare, man. You know, you've literally, I don't sleep well at night anymore thanks to you. And he stands there smirking and goes, welcome to my nightmare. And I said, it's our nightmare, buddy, but it really is. It really is. And every time I see him, he lives just right up the road from me, actually, up here in Black Mountain, North Carolina. And every time I have any correspondence with Bill Forstchen, I'm like, thanks for ruining my life, you know. It is that dire a situation. And I don't think we can go around living in fear, but I don't think people are really aware of the dangerous potential and what they would do in the absence of the convenience that is afforded us in this technological society in which we now live.
And, you know, the other option, the other, you know, event scenario is that there's just a dramatic shift in whether it's, you know, just economic status or, you know, a series of, you know, let's just say that oil gets very expensive, mm-hmm. and that changes everything. You know, what that would do is allow society, it would allow mankind to ease a little more slowly into a new, you know, a new realm, as opposed to just the automatic jolt you know, like an EMP from outer space or from a weapon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are so many different complex possibilities involved in something like that. But either way, well, we've got to go pay the bills, Mike. Listen, I want to thank you for jumping on, you know, and of course, as a friend of Max, you know, sharing those stories. You've done him some justice. I think he'd be smiling down on us or up at us or over from, you know, another dimension, however all that stuff works. Who knows, you know? But Mac, he was an insightful guy. I know he valued you as a friend, and we value you very much for joining us here tonight on the Graylian Report in remembering Mac Tonies.
Thank you so much, Hate, and I will advocate there, if without too much trouble, you can search out online, and there's a lot of interviews that Mac did, and if nothing else, he was a wonderfully engaging conversationalist, and he did something that I very much think is lacking in a lot of the discourse that takes place, where he would speculate. And he would, you know, do it at a, you know, he would basically say, I'm going to speculate now, and then he would speculate, and then he would, you know, just sort of jump back into, you know, facts and figures. But you know, I find that especially in the, you know, the UFO realm and people who do this sort of research, there are far too many folks who don't you know, don't stick to those, you know, sort of rigorous standards, and they will speculate in a way that makes it sound like they really believe what they're saying. Uh-huh. And Mac was not tied in. He loved the act of speculation in a conversational format, and just to see where it would go. And there's a delight in listening to him that I truly miss. And you know, for folks out there, just a simple Google search, you know, Mac Tonies interview audio you'll be left you know, missing him even more. And I will also add that just a few weeks before his death, he did a 3-hour interview on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. Mm-hmm. And it was great. It was just great. You know, George Norrie has obviously listened to every, weary UFO researcher as well as crackpot out there.
Yeah.
And you could literally hear, you know, this, you know, hardened radio personality kind of just get dragged along with Max, you know, in Max shining, you know, optimism. You know, it was really neat to listen to that interview, and Mac was just great. So, you know, just a few weeks before he died, you know, I just felt like he was at his highest point, and he was so wonderful and so engaging on that show, and that's an easy one to search out also.
Excellent. Well, thank you for pointing that out to the listeners. You know, George Norrie, if anyone does, certainly knows talent. We have tremendous respect for him here on the Graylian Report, and of course, you know, he obviously had that same respect for Mac Tonies and having him there on the program. It was a great interview. He was also on Greg Bishop's Radio Mysterioso and a few others. There are also some video interviews with him on YouTube that people can watch, and, you know, there's a multitude of other things out there. But that said, also, before we let you go, tell listeners how they can learn more about you and your work as well, Mike.
I have an online blog, and it is a hiddenexperience.blogspot.com, and I've done a handful of podcasts, and I've been writing about some of my own personal experiences as well as looking into things like the UFO abduction phenomena.
Absolutely, Mike. Thanks again. And, you know, I tell you what, you know, again, it's our pleasure to have you on for a Mac Tonies tribute. Next time I want to have you on just to interview you and talk more about your hidden experience. That'll be our pleasure to have you back on the program, okay?
Great.
Thank you so much, Mike Cleland. And that wraps up, you know, our discussion with Mike Cleland. That was really kind of impromptu, too. Yeah, we were contacted by Mike just at the last second, and he said, you know, hey, I'd be happy to jump on with you tonight because, you know, I knew Mac personally. And, yes, he illustrated Mac's final book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, which was put out by Anomalous Books, A Meditation on Indigenous Humanoids and the Aliens Among Us. It will probably be remembered as one of Mac's finest, maybe his very finest work. It's certainly my favorite. He also wrote a book called After the Martian Apocalypse, but whatever the case may be, it was all insightful stuff that Mac put out there. I wish we could have gotten more of it. And thanks to Mike Cleland, now the listeners of this program know how to find a little bit more about Mac Tonies. We're going to wrap up this hour when we come back with our continuing discussion of the singularity and how that had to do with Mac Tonies and some of his work and research and interest in life. And then in the next hour, Maxim Camera joins us. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be right back.
Thank you. My name is Dale Pazinski, and this is how I live United. I volunteer with United Way, helping the homeless in my community by teaching computer skills and helping them build a basic resume to save on their very own USB drive. It's huge when somebody says, "Hey man, that job that you helped me apply for, I got it." My name is Dale Pazinski. I help people achieve financial independence. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
Hey, what's up? Holla at ya, boy. XOXOXO. You getting these texts? Question mark. Where are you? What are you doing? OMG, you are making me mad. You better text me back. I'm waiting outside your house.
Relentless, aggressive texting is like sending an angry robot to deliver your message. When does the robot become dangerous? Let us know at thatsnotcool.com.
Thatsnotcool.com.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Back to the program, discussing Mac Tony's The Singularity, which many say is near, very near, and a multitude of other strange subjects. It is your weekly Graylin Report. I'm your happy host, Mr. Micah Hanks, broadcasting from hundreds and hundreds of miles below terra firma here in the Graylin Bunker, our dark corner of the web, where we bring you weekly insights into the strange and the unusual. This is the place where conspiracy theory becomes conspiracy fact. I suspect next week we're going to be talking more about conspiracy theories, but I don't call them conspiracy theories when we discuss them on the program, and I'll tell you why. Because if you have facts that you can use to back up what you're discussing, it isn't a theory. Most of what we deal with in science and most of what we deal with in terms of UFOs and strange phenomena is theoretical, you know. And much like Mike was saying about the late Mac Tony's and his thought processes involving this sort of thing, he would be open to speculate and to speak, you know, theoretically, but he wouldn't give himself to those things and say, "This is what I believe." That is a constant qualm I have with the state of ufology today. The study of UFOs is riddled with people who will argue almost indefinitely that aliens are represented by extraterrestrial intelligence from outer space. Space beings, aliens if you will, that travel in physical craft from other planets to planet Earth. And what's so funny is that while there are the skeptics who would really laugh at and ridicule the people who advocate that kind of theory, there are people who are so-called ufologists. Now, I won't be mean and say that they're so-called ufologists. I've got a lot of friends who are UFO researchers who are probably about as diehard when it comes to their, you know, belief along those lines as anyone. I respect them, although I agree to differ with them, but the thing is that they would probably laugh at me for, you know, trying to pose alternative theories or, you know, expressing my outright disgust with people's being married and becoming married over the last several decades, especially to the idea of physical, alien, extraterrestrial beings from other planets. We don't have any scientific proof of that. We have a lot of speculation, but we don't have any hard evidence that backs that up. And that, my friends, is why we can't allow theories to rule our thought processes and become an actual dogma that we attach ourselves to. But when you are able to attribute facts to anything, then it's no longer theory. I know for a fact, for instance, that my producer Chris Hayes zombie that he may be is sitting in this chair right in front of me, and therefore I don't have to have a theory about there being a producer live in the studio with me. I'm fortunate enough to be able to say that it is a scientific fact that Mr. Chris Hayes is present in the studio with me.
You know, Micah, you just have to realize that I'm not sitting in the chair. The world is sitting around me.
Ah, yes.
Once you realize that, then you'll know.
Well said, my friend. But either way, conspiracy theory becomes conspiracy fact on this program, because as often as possible, except for when we're speculating, and we do a lot of speculating on this program, but other than that, we do like to bring you facts. When I was discussing singularity with Mike Cleland a moment ago, and in the final minutes of this hour, we'll try and jump back into some of our, you know, it was getting a little heated earlier between the two of you guys, because, you know, I think that there's such
and you decided to bring it down a notch.
Did I?
You did.
How?
Yeah. You brought in someone else to talk. You were like, all right, stay on the phone longer so they won't argue like
this. I can't
okay.
help that Mike...
It's okay. Me and Matt kissed and made up, but...
Mike just happens to be really well qualified to speak about Mac Tonys. I wasn't trying to bring anything down a notch. I don't censor people on this program, okay?
Could you put a lid on it?
Look, no, you put on a lid. put lid on it. Just, you know, would you just be my friend? Listen.
Just put on a lid.
Let me tell you something. Okay, buddy, I don't appreciate you little punks, okay, in your misfit shirt and your earphones coming in here and accusing me of bringing things down a notch.
So I'm shirtless? Is that what you're telling the audience?
No, that's... I'm about to give you an Alex Jones scream. You know, I don't think it's very nice of you to come in here and act like that. And talk to me like that and act like this is somebody else's show. You know whose radio program this is? You know what it's like? Sorry. I was just jonesing for some Jones, folks. I apologize.
You're going to feed on...
Would you pipe down back there? Put a lid on it.
Didn't know if it was appropriate.
You know what? With engineers like you, Matt, we don't need... friends. Wait a minute. Obviously, my brain's been completely scrambled.
That's a compliment you just gave him.
Yeah, my brain's been completely scrambled by all this singularitarian talk. That's a big word. Huh? Can you say that? Singularitarian? You know what that is? This is what Ray Kurzweil and the guys call people who have embraced the notion of a singularity. I'm sorry, Matt, I don't think you are a fellow singularitarian.
I'm not.
But to be honest with you, I don't know if I am either. Just to be quite frank, and you guys can still be Chris and Matt, but... I don't know that I would call myself a singularitarian. I'm someone who's very interested in the singularity, primarily because of how it relates to, you know, the furtherance of the sciences and, of course, what I perceive as a likely theory as to the origin of UFOs. Now, we've talked about this already. We've teased all program. In the next hour, we are going to tone things down a little bit, I suspect, in the next hour, because we've got a very scholarly, intellectual individual, Dr. Maxim Ivanovich Kammerer, who's going to be joining us here on the program. Dr. Kammerer is, he's got some very, very knowledgeable, insightful views toward UFO phenomenon. He also happened to have a tremendous and profound respect for the work of the late Mac Tonys. And he actually, although he, you know, corresponds pretty frequently with me outside of this program, and he's a listener of the program, he's working on a manuscript, which I'm assuming he'll delve into discussing a little bit during the next hour with us. But Dr. Kammerer, and actually I've read portions of this manuscript myself, and I'm aware of, you know, the content featured in it. I think it's absolutely brilliant. This manuscript will seek to explain some of the physics and the philosophical implications behind the work of Dr. Jacques Vallée and his investigation over the last several decades into the UFO enigma. But he also discusses Mac Tonys a good bit in the manuscript. And so Dr. Kammerer actually was the one that contacted me and said, you know, Micah, what would be wonderful? And he doesn't grant a lot of interviews. Dr. Kammerer, he's quite an enigmatic, you know, character, and he keeps to himself a lot. But he contacted me and he said, you know, I think it would be really great if we did some sort of a tribute to Mac. And it was his idea entirely. And I looked at the calendar and thought, my, this is remarkable. Because we're doing the show on Tuesdays now, and this Tuesday will actually fall on the anniversary of Mac's death.
This is Tuesday?
Would you put a lid on it? Because we're being serious right now.
Sorry.
And so the thing is that working out as well as that did, I thought, you know, who better to have on the program than Dr. Kammerer, who will be joining us at the top of the next hour to discuss this further. And that said, it's time to go pay more bills. I am Micah Hanks, joined in studio by a couple of hoodlums. You guys aren't singularitarians. And we, of course, are your weekly friends, your light in the darkness, if you will, even though we're broadcasting from hundreds of miles below the Earth's surface here in the Moho Discontinuity. I am Micah Hanks. This is your Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this, continuing our Mac Tony's tribute.
Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome to the third and final hour of this week's edition of the program. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, joined in studio by producer Chris Hayes and engineer Matt the Reverend Oakley. Always doing a fine job back there on the master console here at Graylian International Headquarters. I wouldn't want to call it a sad day, but I do find that today's date, October 18th, 2011, is a day of reflection personally for me. There was a brilliant young researcher who we have alluded to several times during tonight's broadcast already, who 2 years ago today, it was October 18th, 2009, passed away rather unexpectedly. He was a brilliant man. He was a futurist, a transhumanist. He was also known in UFO circles for some of his bold and innovative theories, which culminated in a final manuscript published by Anomalous Books. It was published posthumously, of course, and we are, yes, talking about the late, great Mac Tonies. The book was called The Crypto-Terrestrials, and it dealt with the idea that, well, when we're talking about UFOs and strange phenomena related to UFOs, what if the answers to this strange enigma actually lay closer to home than many realize? It's a strange possibility. Very few really, I think, today take time to truly consider the implications of such ideas. But if indeed what we're dealing with when it comes to UFOs were not the conventional extraterrestrial phenomena that everyone typically attributes to the discussion of UFOs, in other words, aliens visiting Earth, well, then what could they be? Tony's book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, went into that. And it's a short manuscript, arguably partially due to the fact that he was in the middle of completing that work when he passed away very suddenly. And who knows what innovative thinkers like Mac Tonies might have gone on to do. I was just getting to know him when he passed away, and therefore, we felt it was a quite appropriate on tonight's program to do a sort of tribute to Mac Tony's. When I say we, of course, I speak on behalf of not just myself and those here at Graylian International, but our guest who joins us tonight on the program to discuss Mac Tony's and his work. Joining us now is someone who I feel is particularly well-equipped to discuss the implications of what Tony's called a crypto-terrestrial presence among us here on Earth, in addition to expanding on some of his other theories, especially those regarding the future of humanity. Dr. Maxim Ivanovich Kammerer is a researcher whose work in culture and science has been published internationally, and he now joins us here on the Graylian Report in remembering Mac Tony's. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kammerer.
Thank you, Micah. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's always good to be able to speak with you. You are, of course, a friend and an academic inspiration for me. And so, without further ado, we share a mutual admiration for the work of Mac Tony's. I'd just barely begun to really get to know him before he died rather suddenly at the age of only 34 years, 2 years ago. This was October 18th, 2009. So what I'd like to begin by asking you is to tell us about Mac Tony's and how he inspired you with his own inquiry into the less conventional aspects of our physical existence.
Yes, well, I didn't know Mac Tony's. Personally, I didn't have that pleasure the way you did. And in fact, I first heard of him and heard him himself on the internet only shortly before his death. In fact, and that was in the final interview he gave for Greg Bishop at Radio Mysterioso. And that was, I believe, I may be incorrect, but I believe that was late July 2009. And so having not known him personally, I can only judge him as a human being, you know, based on the statements of those who knew him. And from what I and everyone else in the public can hear and deduce is that no one had anything bad to say about Mac Tony's. He was an exemplary human being, a very insightful thinker and very articulate. I'm quite good, I think, when it comes to writing, but not always to live speaking. But Mac Tony's excelled in his articulateness. He was very articulate. That comes through in his interviews, where he obviously was speaking live, but also anyone can go over to his blog that remains up online and read any of those entries. And all of them have the obvious marks of a very articulate person, although he didn't have a higher education. He was extremely well-read. And that, in fact, I think, in general, will give you a better education. Oh, if you're self-motivated and if you are well-read, you'll probably have better insights and more wisdom than most people with a PhD. To get a PhD these days, at least, doesn't require that much wisdom or knowledge anymore, unfortunately. At the very least, if one has a PhD these days, it will indicate that they have the character trait of perseverance. But in any way, I do believe in self-education and the importance of reading. Mac Tony's was very well read and read well read in several fields, you know, science, physics, psychology, transhumanism. And this is what interested me in Mac Tony's, actually, was his what he had to say about transhumanism and the transhumanist movement. That is basically the set of ideas generally associated with names like Nick Bostrom at Oxford, and also more famously Ray Kurzweil. And the transhumanist movement, its proponents speak of a coming singularity involving artificial intelligence, that is, computers becoming self-aware or having the ability for recursive thought, just as humans do. So this is how I came to know Mac Tony's. over the internet. And in that final interview he gave for Greg Bishop at Radio Mysterioso, which I hold to be one of the most important interviews and discussions of the UFO phenomenon that you can find anywhere on the internet. It's actually quite profound, and it's if I can exaggerate a little bit, it's light years away from the usual thinking among ufologists that UFOs equal alien spacecraft from some extraterrestrial, extrasolar solar system or some of the galaxy or what have you.
Right.
Because if you listen to that interview, and I urge everyone listening to this to look up that interview online at Radio Mysterioso and listen to it. It's quite profound. You know, there's a discussion about matrix and simulation hypothesis, consciousness. It's quite fascinating, much more fascinating than just the old idea that UFOs are simply nuts and bolts spacecraft with occupants consisting of flesh and blood emanating from some other solar system, let's say Zeta Reticuli. So this, I think, is a good starting point for the audience, anyone in the audience who may not know MacTonis, to go over to Radio Mysterio. So listen to that final interview from July 2009 with MacTonis. You will get to know, I think, a very gifted mind if you listen to that interview.
Indeed, and we'll hope to have that interview linked up over at the Graylian Report website, in addition to having a link to your blog, which I want to discuss here in a moment. I do wonder, and I hope sincerely that, you know, I don't know what the circumstances were with, you know, the server that Tony's hosted his blog, which was called Posthuman Blues. I hope that that will remain online, of course, indefinitely, because, again, you know, it is, although the Cryptoterrestrials, which Anomalous Books released, you know, just after his death, actually, as I understand the story. And at the time that, you know, when I learned that Tony's had passed away, you know, I'd been in contact not only with Nick Redfern that morning, who wrote one of the forewords for the book, but also with the publisher, Patrick Weege. Patrick, of course, you know, had told me that they were hoping to, you know, salvage the manuscript and be able to obtain it. His mother, MacTonis' mother, did manage to get that manuscript and pass it along to Patrick Weege, and so it was published after his passage. But the book, you know, of course, is brilliant, but then again, I think that, you know, Mac's insights go so far beyond the single kind of window, you know, of understanding that that book provides. So, again, I hope that the Posthuman Blues website will stay up indefinitely. And speaking of blogs, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, we all do, because there's some very insightful content, but also some very entertaining content.
Oh, certainly. He had an eye for you know, quirky technological, you know, little tidbits and things, so it was a very entertaining blog in addition to being very insightful. Now, speaking of insightful blogs, your own blog, which is called Maxim Kammerer, Science and Culture of the Esoteric, we'll have that link for our listeners at Graylian Report as well, but you recently detailed a new theory of ufology of your own. It was called, or rather it was featured in a post titled The New UFO Hypothesis, Artificial Intelligence, Matrix Simulation World, and Post-Singularity Homo Mechanicus. Can you tell us a little bit about that theory?
Yes. Well, I would start by stressing that it is a theory. I don't think, well, I know, no one can claim to actually know what UFOs are, not to mention the fact that, you know, when we speak of the UFO phenomenon, in the singular, it's very likely, if not beyond a doubt, really somewhat incorrect. We should be speaking of the UFO phenomena in the plural, because obviously some UFO sightings will involve classified military technology. Others will involve hallucinations or illusions. But there does seem to be a very small percentage of truly inexplicable and enigmatic cases. So my meditations on the UFO phenomena is simply that. It's a meditation, it's a theory, it's a hypothesis that I am exploring in a manuscript that I've prepared. So it's an idea that I explore. It's not a dogma or a belief that I hold to. Now, in general, I think that those words that make up the title to the post that you just quoted sort of gives you the general components of the hypothesis. Mm-hmm. It's more or less a transhumanist exploration, you know, the UFO phenomenon. And Mac Tony's, even though his name is associated now with the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis, if one reads his blog and if one listens to that Radio Mysterioso interview, as well as the Coast to Coast interview that he gave, one will see that, you know, he had more to say about the UFO enigma than what he says in his crypto-terrestrial book.
Certainly, yeah.
Which, as you said, was published posthumously on account of his tragic young death at age 34. Now, Tony's emphasis, and I do think that his main emphasis, if you read his blog, his main emphasis is transhumanism or futurism. Mm-hmm. And he generally views or investigates the UFO phenomena from that perspective. So it's very much associated with technology and future technology revolving around this idea of the coming singularity in artificial intelligence. Tony's, one has to respect his posture because he explored several ideas in his interviews, in his writings, and on his blog. But he wasn't really wedded to any of them.
Right.
He was trying to, I think, take a dispassionate look, you know, at the general characteristics of the UFO phenomenon and the enigmas associated with it. So that said, you find him exploring several different possibilities, you know, from the possibility of UFOs representing extraterrestrial sort of post-singularity technology, Newman probes, but also perhaps that we live in a matrix world and UFOs are perhaps some kind of code that's being generated on some screen somewhere. So he was a quite, imaginative thinker, mm-hmm. and not in a pejorative sense. Science is built on the imagination. The frontiers of science are pushed forward by the imagination. As Einstein often made this point that really imagination is more important than knowledge. And this is fundamentally applicable to science. One hesitates to broach the subject of this hypothesis because it's truly reality collapsing, reality challenging. Mm-hmm. The basic idea was really inspired by Jacques Vallée's UFO hypothesis, or the so-called interdimensional hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But more fundamentally, it's based on the physics, the Einsteinian relativity physics and quantum physics that Vallée's interdimensional hypothesis is based upon.
Which I would also say probably is something that a lot of UFO researchers who are looking so closely at the nuts and bolts phenomenon tend to overlook when they read Jacques Vallée's research. They tend, I think, to overlook the implications of the space-time angle and how relativity and other, you know, modern, you know, foundations of physics, you know, really come into play with this. I think that there's a lot of misinterpretation of the idea of the dimensions that Vallée talked about as well, which I presume you're about to get back to here in a moment anyway, so I'll let you continue.
Well, let's cut to the chase. There is a lot of misinterpretation or misunderstanding or a failure to understand Vallée's writings and especially his interdimensional hypothesis because it requires quite a bit of knowledge of advanced science, advanced physics, especially Einsteinian physics and quantum physics, but even beyond quantum physics. Vallée is really pushing the frontiers of science and physics here. And one way he does that is to merge quantum physics with information theory, because after all, he does have a professional background in computer science, information science, and he was writing about the physics of information long before that phrase started to appear in mainstream information science. Or information sciences publications. You can find this phrase throughout that literature now, but the very phrase itself, the physics of information, as far as I know, appeared first in Vallée's writings before somehow filtered its way or was independently crafted among professionals in information sciences,
right,
dealing with computer technology and also the philosophy of computer technology and information science. We'll get into this in more depth, I'm sure, in a bit here, just how radical Vallée's ideas are. But this really is not meant in a pejorative sense, because after all, Einstein and quantum physics, well, if nothing, if those are not radical, nothing is. And yet, they are upheld and confirmed by repeatable scientific experiments. And the UFO phenomenon is quite radical itself. And I think that the science that has to be applied in order to at least to try to understand that thing also, it must be radical.
Oh, yes.
And quite frankly, that requires a lot of reading, a lot of education in various fields of science, not only in physics, but also in information science and also in psychology, epistemology, philosophy, because all of those issues are involved in quantum physics and the special theory of relativity, especially, not to mention the general theory of relativity.
Mm-hmm. Most certainly. And it's interesting to me. I don't want to make a blanket statement and say that the majority of ufologists are not, well versed in a multitude of disciplines and are not, well educated. That certainly is not the case. But I do think, though, that whereas there is so much that can be gained from learning and observing the UFO enigma, kind of through not just a technological or a scientific filter, so to speak, but also, through a philosophical filter, through a cultural, a folkloric, and even in terms of, a religious kind of, perspective. I mean, Vallée's work, encompasses all these things, especially with his book, Passport to Magonia, where he looks at the similarities between UFO reports in the modern day and then, of course, folklore and contact with non-human entities in, you know, fairy tales and folklore, you know, from not just yes. decades and centuries, but perhaps thousands of years, you know, spanning the human experience. So, indeed, Valle himself is multidisciplined. I wish that more people today were open to those kinds of interpretations, but you see that when people, the nuts and bolts crowd, I'll say, people who are really, really kind of convinced that UFOs are one of two things, you know, either all entirely government craft, or the majority are that, and then there are a few that are also extraterrestrial craft from outer space. There's very little scientific foundation for those ideas, you know, either. Those are theories. Again, kind of like you had said with due hesitation, you know, before articulating your own ideas here. You know, this, folks, is a theory. We need to treat it as such. And being a theory, as it is, I think, you know, any theory should be treated, you know, carefully and shouldn't be passed along as a gospel truth. But, you know, as I'm sure you would agree, Dr. Kammerer, you know, that, you know, this statement I'm making here isn't to be dismissive toward researchers or even, in, you know, people in academic circles. I think that, you know, the key here is open-mindedness. Would you share that sentiment?
Oh, well, of course, I think any sane person would. I would want to emphasize also that, apropos of what I said before, you know, even physicists who have a PhD, you know, find it difficult to wrap their heads around these advanced concepts of relativity theory and quantum physics. So, you know, I wasn't intending to be arrogant at all, you know, or implying that, well, you know, I have a PhD and you don't, you're a layperson, uneducated, so I know what I'm talking about and you don't. When it comes to advanced concepts in space-time and relativity and quantum physics, no one really knows what they're talking about, essentially speaking. In details, yes, but essentially speaking, no one knows the full picture. No one has the final answer yet. And in fact, you know, based on Gödel's incompleteness theorem, I'm of the persuasion that there is no final answer to scientific questions. There will always be room for further precision in approximation and articulation of truth statements. So.
Well, you know, and it's interesting to me that what you outline so carefully there, you know, sums up to me the way that the scientific establishment so often treats such matters as UFOs or other strange phenomena. It usually comes down to a matter of one of two things. Either our knowledge of science is, you know, and this is, of course, the mistaken perception that our knowledge of science is already complete or nearing completion. Any good scientist, I think, as you've outlined, you know, will be very careful to make such statement or to fall into such a system of belief that we know really everything, or at very least more than we, you know, than we think think we do or think we should. There is indeed so much more that can be expanded on. And the other attitude, I think, is that although we don't know everything, you know, clearly something like the idea of interplanetary visitors or physics anomalies, whatever UFOs may actually represent, this is not something that can be quantified easily with our present understanding of science, and therefore it should not be. This was the attitude that was taken by the Condon Committee, you know, in the 1960s, which, of course, coincided with the end of the Air Force's Project Blue Book here in the States. And that's such a problem to me, because the attitude that if we can't gain something scientifically from studying UFOs, therefore we shouldn't study them at all, that seems so oxymoronic. It's you know, it's a self-defeating kind of attitude. How do you hope to understand a phenomenon or gain further scientific knowledge by ignoring it? That doesn't make sense to me.
It seems to be, you know, arguing partly from a utilitarian aspect. You know, if we can't use this knowledge, you know, to improve our daily lives as some technological gadget or something along that line, then, you know, it's not worth pursuing. Perhaps, you know, that assumption was operative there. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, science does deal with orders and levels of evidence and the assessment and analysis of evidence. One must keep an open mind when one is exploring, trying to achieve answers to a riddle in science. And so the general approach is to formulates several workable hypotheses, and then to test usually a different group or researcher to test each of those hypotheses and to look at the varying degrees of probability now in the evidence. So there are some hypotheses that are more likely than other hypotheses. And, you know, once a hypothesis garners enough evidence, then it's graduated to the level of a theory. You know, so a theory has a little more weight than what we call a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, really, all so-called theories about UFOs really at this point are actually hypotheses.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because, you know, where is the evidence to demonstrate it? But on the same token, as I said, some hypotheses will be more likely than others. This is the reason why it's valid, you know, from a scientific perspective, to look at the characteristics of the UFO phenomenon or the various UFO phenomena, and you know, try to categorize the hypotheses which might be more likely than the others, because personally, when you take that approach, I would argue that, say, the ETH, or the extraterrestrial hypothesis, you know, I wouldn't put it up as high on the ladder of probability as you know, competing hypotheses. But we really probably don't have the time to go you know, into a comparison of all of this, but I just want to state the general principle that scientists operate with. And that is that scientific open-mindedness does not mean that all hypotheses are, you know, equally probable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can sift through the evidence, and that's what we must do in order to formulate hypotheses in the first place. And in that process, you know, of sorting the evidence and establishing the various levels of probability, you know, we are able to situate the different hypotheses, you know, on different rungs of the ladder of evidence. Some are more likely than others. But, you know, in the end, still, we're, at this point, we're all speaking about hypotheses.
Yeah, very clearly, you know, articulated there, by the way, because, you know, I like that you point out that while we have to be careful about making assumptions, this is one reason I see that, you know, the quote-unquote UFO skeptic crowd, you know, tends to ridicule so-called ufologists, you know, and I've gone after them for doing so in the past because they start with the assumption that all people who research this brand of phenomenon are going along the, you know, along the pretense that what we're dealing with is something extraterrestrial, and by extraterrestrial, I mean the definition that involves something from outside planet Earth, elsewhere in space, that traveled here per se, you know, from another planet. So I'm glad that
you know, that's craft. Yes.
Right, exactly. Which, you know, it's interesting that you note that not only is that to be treated as a hypothesis, but it may be a less likely hypothesis than others. And this is not a theory that you have you know, espoused and that I happen to agree with entirely, but that also Dr. Vallée, you know, has dealt with a great deal in his work. He, you know, in addition to being regarded is one of the world's greatest ufologists. You know, he is also, of course, a computer scientist and someone who has applied a lot of logic and a lot of his own observations and scientific, you know, determinations to studying this phenomenon. And he seems to feel, as, you know, again, articulated quite clearly in his books, that he doesn't feel, his gut tells him that you know, that this is probably not an extraterrestrial phenomenon, but maybe a variety of things that are indeed interdimensional in nature. Now, you, of course, at your blog have mentioned that you've recently penned a manuscript that will hopefully be published early next year. It compares some of Vallée's ideas of the unity of matter and consciousness to David Bohm's theory of the implicate order. That's something that we've discussed, you know, probably only briefly before on this program, and so I'm glad to have you here to be able to discuss this maybe a bit more in depth. As stated at your blog, it details essentially how matter and the mind are generated by an underlying implicate order, which consists of pre-consciousness and pre-matter existing as a single, interpenetrating, and inseparable phenomena. So what I ask you now is, how do you relate ideas such as Bohm's theories of an implicate order with the research of the ufology as practiced by Dr. Jacques Vallée?
Well, here we get to the heart of the subject, or the meat, if you will. Sure. Vallée notes that UFOs exhibit both material and immaterial aspects. And he relates this to de Beauregard's observations on the links between matter and consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now, according to de Beauregard, the link between matter and consciousness is probability. But we can put that aside for now, and because really the main point here is that de Beauregard's thought is obviously related to Einstein's special theory of relativity and the equivalency between mass and energy. You remember the famous E equals mc squared. Energy is equivalent to mass times the speed of light squared. But we're not only dealing with an equivalency between mass or matter and energy, but with a more fundamental underlying reality that enables us to unify the two. So when we apply that paradigm from relativity to matter and consciousness, de Beauregard's thinking, and therefore de Vallée's ideas, because he's citing de Beauregard on the link between the material and the immaterial, or between matter and consciousness, then these ideas connect up with David Bohm's theories on the implicate order and what he called in his last paper, which is actually published posthumously, soma significance. Now, the implicate order is an underlying order that generates space-time. And also it generates matter and consciousness. Now, the outward or visible universe, visible existence, things that exist, Bohm calls this the contents of the explicate order, the outward order. Mm-hmm. Whereas the implicate order is sort of the underlying order that actually generates space-time and matter and consciousness. Now, his soma significance theory really goes hand in hand with this implicate order. That is, now, when you think of consciousness or the mind and matter, or let's say, to be more specific, make that general matter something specific, that is the body.
Sure.
So you come up with the mind-body contrast. Now, in our general way of thinking, we think that the mind is one existent, or one substance, one entity, and that the body is another, so that you have two. Some people are a little more unitive in their thought, and they talk about psychosomatic relationship. But Bohm even criticizes that. He says that's still too dualistic, because it implies that there's a separate mind and a separate body that are interacting with each other and that influence each other.
Hmm.
Whereas what Bohm is arguing in his theory of the implicate order and soma significance is that mind and the body are really something like two sides of a single coin, or they're two aspects or modes of a single reality.
Hmm. Which should make sense entirely. I mean, the unification of the mind and the body. It's funny to me that people, would ever consider these two things to be separate from one another.
Yes, and Bohm points out that at the most fundamental level, see, as you approach the Planck length and below, that he says that even at that level, matter is sentient-like or conscious-like. It's not conscious to the degree or in the mode, say, that an animal or that humans are. But nevertheless, there is concrete evidence, that the smallest particles of matter do exhibit some kind of conscious-like or sentient-like behaviors or activities. And Bohm deduces from this that there is significance or meaning or a sort of pre-consciousness within matter. In other words, we can't have matter without that matter possessing some element of you know, a sentient like you know, characteristic, so that there is no matter apart from mind or consciousness. And I would even argue that there's no mind apart from the body, but that's not central, but it is related to these ideas. Mm-hmm. Now, according to Bohm, at the implicate order, what on a higher order, looks like two separate substances turns out to be only one. He gives the for those who've read Bohm, the famous analogy of the fish in an aquarium. Now, if you have two different cameras at two different angles pointed at an aquarium, filming a fish, and you set up two screens in a separate room, and you have a person look at the two different screens, they're going to be viewing, they're going to be viewing a single fish, but from two different perspectives, from two different angles. Now, if they don't know this, they're going to assume that they're two fish. And they're going to assume, because, when the one fish moves on the one screen, the other moves in the same way, but just, on a different angle or in a different direction, that they must be in contact with each other and that they are causally interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. There's a cause and effect relationship between their similar movements. And this involves his concept of holography, or the cosmos as a holograph.
Yes.
And so now this, you apply it to the question of the mind and body, or matter and consciousness. Due to a holographic effect, we are laboring under the illusion that mind and matter are two different fish, when they're really only one. Now, also according to Bohm, at the deepest levels of the implicate order, space-time breaks down to the point of being absent or non-existent, because actually the implicate order at that level actually generates space-time. So the implicate order really is characterized by what's called pre-space. I prefer to call it pre-space-time, mm-hmm. because since Hermann Minkowski, we really should be aware that space and time are a single, unified, inseparable entity. There really isn't such a thing as space apart from time or time apart from space. And this is why now, for decades now, physics books, textbooks, employ this compound noun, space-time, mm-hmm. as a single word, without any hyphen between space and time. It's just space-time, a single word. This goes back to the insights of Hermann Minkowski, which the Soviet, of course, based on special relativity, which saw time as a fourth spatial dimension, so it geometrized time, so to speak. Now, for Bohm, space-time is absent, does not exist. At the most fundamental level in the implicate order. Now, Vallée is even more radical because he contends that the modern notion of space-time itself is a cultural artifact, based chiefly on the invention of graph paper. Bohm has also advanced the theory, as I said, of cosmic holography. But the cosmic model, as a holograph, what this is doing is taking away spatial dimensions. There aren't two fish, there's only one. Now, so you apply that, as an analogy to space-time. Now, so, the physicist Niall Turok, he's argued that this holography model might arguably take space-time dimensions down from 4 to 3, and ultimately you could even take it down to 0. So that space-time, in the end, will be revealed as a mere approximation of a more fundamental reality. I'm reminded, of Werner Heisenberg, who argued that space-time is what he called an anthropomorphic idea or a projection, of the human mind. Now, I wouldn't really go so far as to say, you know, that space and time don't exist. Mm-hmm. What I would do is qualify that and say that space-time exists, you know, as a simulacrum of a more fundamental reality. So, you know, on certain levels, space-time simply doesn't matter. And for all practical purposes, it doesn't exist, you know, in the way that we usually conceive of it, you know, in a chronological linear mode. Now, Vallée is far more radical than Bohm, because Bohm takes the space-time seriously and only calls it into question at the deepest levels of the implicate order, or at the pre-space level. You know, Vallée's multiverse doesn't consist of extra spatial dimensions in the sense, you know, that string theory holds.
String theory, right, yeah.
Right, they're arguing that there are 10 or 11 dimensions or what have you. Bohmian holography, it operates in the reverse direction. Instead of adding dimensions, it takes them away, even to the point that some are coming to the conclusion that space and time, or space-time, might actually be doomed. It might not really exist in the mode that we perceive it, you know, in our everyday lives.
Which is fascinating, because if it doesn't, you know, then what are we perceiving? What does exist if what we know of space-time is almost entirely an illusion?
Well, this again would go back to Hermann Minkowski. See, the theory, and I do believe, you know, it's a theory, not a hypothesis, of the block model. Now, the block universe model, which is based on Hermann Minkowski's you know, unit of space-time concept and geometrization of time, you know, via special relativity. And this basically argues that the universe is four-dimensional in the sense that time is a fourth spatial dimension. In our everyday lives, our consciousness perceives a flow of time, and an arrow attaches itself to that. There's an arrow of time. It goes from the past to the future, so that the past used to be past, but it doesn't exist anymore, which is why we call it the past. And the future doesn't exist, but when it arrives, it will exist. You know?
Yes.
The only thing that exists is the present, and this is in philosophy and in physics is called presentism. You know, only the present exists.
Well, it did exist a moment ago when you said it did, right?
Precisely. You can't really pin it down, so it's just as elusive as the past or the present. But you see, what the block universe model proposes is that all points in time, what we call past, present, and future, actually coexist simultaneously, just as do all space-time, or rather all space points, you know, all points in space. When you walk through a field, for example, you know, and you go from point A to point B, you know, from your origin to your destination, you can see your destination from point A. You can see all those points of space between points A and B. You know that as you begin to walk towards your destination, that the space points that you're walking through, or the ground you're walking on, you know, the space points that are not coming into existence as you, you know, put one foot in front of the other.
Sure.
And begin to proceed. It's all there. All the space points coexist simultaneously. Now, the block universe model is arguing that time points exist in the same way, but that our consciousness, you know, is structured in such a way that it imposes limitations on our view. We can only see the bit of those time points that's right in front of our consciousness.
That is now, fascinating stuff. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Continue.
Well, some of the most convincing arguments for the correctness of this model, you know, are the kinematic effects of special relativity, namely time dilation and the Lorentz mm-hmm. contraction. For instance, the best way to interpret the Lorentz contraction would be that, you know, when you two different people take two different measurements of a single object, let's say a piece of wood, you know, and they come up with two different measurements, you know, as guided by the Lorentz contraction. The best explanation for that, I believe, would be that the reason that those two measurers are coming up with two different measurements is that each of them are measuring two different three-dimensional slices of what's called the four-dimensional world tube of that piece of wood. The world tube simply means the piece of wood as it exists, you know, from the beginning to the end, you know, of its subsistence. For instance, you as your 4D world tube would be Micah Hinks from the moment of your conception to the moment of your death. And when you look in the mirror, what you are seeing is a three-dimensional slice of that four-dimensional Micah Hinks that exists fully in a temporal sense, past, present, future. But your consciousness is limited and only sees a three-dimensional slice of that four-dimensional fullness.
That is right in front of me.
Yes, this is extremely complex. This is why I said even physicists, you know, have a hard time wrapping their heads around these concepts, because this is not the way that our minds have been designed to function. Our minds were designed to function, you know, for short-term survival needs, not to think about, you know, four-dimensional world tubes and 3D slices thereof.
And that presents an interesting situation, too, though. I have to say, you know, what happens when the human, which is designed to perform a certain, I don't want to say task, but, you know, perform in a certain way in our environment, perceptually, you know, three-dimensionally, we'll say, what happens when we begin to think so far beyond the bounds of our own, you know, design? Is this the very definition of evolution? What is that we deal with when we begin to try and step beyond the boundaries of our own limitations as humans and as three-dimensional beings?
Well, I think so, yes. The tension that this kind of thinking generates certainly can extend, you know, the frontiers of knowledge, but not only the frontiers of knowledge, but the actual modes of human cognition. Now, and what I'm hinting at there is that the more and more one tries to think about, you know, basically a timeless universe, the more one may actually be changing one's own consciousness and their cognitive modes. It's a quite fascinating area, and it actually ties into, you know, my own transhumanist interpretation of the UFO phenomenon. First of all, you know, language operates within three-dimensional boundaries. You know, for instance, the tenses of language, you know, past, present, and future, the basic three. There are more depending on which language you're talking about. Some languages have, you know, seven tenses. But language, you know, it operates within the boundaries of space and time. So when you try to speak about something that transcends the categories and the boundaries of space and time, you know, it tends to become ineffable. What really can you say about it directly? You can't. You have to speak about it indirectly. No, it's like when you view a low magnitude star at night. If you look directly at it, it will fade from your field of vision. But if you look to the side of it, you can barely see it, but you can see it. That's the way the mind is with these advanced concepts. We can't address them directly because language doesn't allow us to. So we have to employ language, you know, in an analogical or a metaphorical sense. We can also invoke mathematics also to a certain degree.
I like that analogy. I like that analogy a lot, by the way, because that illustrates pretty lucidly, not just our limitations, but what role things like language and mathematics actually play in all this. They are symbols. They are our best ability to interpret and then essentially create some sort of a tangible representation of those thought processes and these concepts, which really is fascinating to me, because it brings to mind questions such as, in the absence of language and symbols that represent concepts, do those concepts even exist? Can advanced thought even exist outside of the symbology associated with them? Before we dive too deep down that rabbit hole, though, I know that we are running short on time. I want to ask you something else, because we just begun to touch on it, how this all, we've gotten into the realm of quantum physics and consciousness, a holographic notion of the universe. These are all very bold concepts, and I appreciate you, Maxim, coming on the program and, of course, illustrating them so clearly for us. I think that this it puts a lot of these ideas in a format that is again clear and very understandable. But in terms of how it does relate to ufology and how your theories of future humans come into play, I'd like to discuss briefly the idea that Kurzweil and that Werner Vinge and so many others have described in terms of there being some sort of a technological singularity. And also your theory of future humans existing in a post-singularity or singularity world in which we would be vastly different. The humans and the world itself would be vastly different from the world that we know today. It does remind us of some of the ideas about a matrix-like reality that might exist, not just in the sense of the film, but in also the conceptual, I guess, imaginings of others who have described a matrix-like world or a matrix-like reality. Mac Tony's discussed that in his work just as well, and his interest in this area is almost overshadowed by the more obviously well-known book, The Crypto-Terrestrials. And so what are your thoughts on Tony's own interpretations of future humans, the coming singularity, and what we might call a matrix reality, and how does that work into your theory of our future as humans?
Most of Tony's interpretations reflected the mainstream thought in the transhumanist movements. For example, the ideas of Nick Bostrom at Oxford, whom I've already mentioned, and Ray Kurzweil, and the idea of a coming singularity when computers become self-aware. Now, this usually includes the idea of what we could call an intermediate cyborg, when humans become half or semi-computerized, if you will, before losing their biology and physicality altogether and becoming utterly replaced with pure artificial intelligence. Usually the thought is that it's housed in some kind of metallic cage or something along those lines. Now, I think that there is a possibility that artificial intelligence may not be realizable. Now, there are some respected thinkers who have some valid arguments that point in that direction, but no one really knows at this point. One possibility that I tend to gravitate towards is that the singularity might involve what Werner Vinge calls IA, that is intelligence amplification, rather than AI or artificial intelligence. Now, what this involves is the scenario where computers might not become self-aware, but humans might become computerized while retaining at least some of their biology. As I say, the transhumanist movement and Tony's reflecting the mainstream transhumanist thought viewed the cyborg stage as intermediate, and he looked forward to the pure AI when physicality would be completely abandoned. Now that may lie somewhere in the remote future. I tend to suspect that that when that happens, that the survival of what we call consciousness, will not have to be bound to another mode of physicality, namely, a metal computer. Right. It could be housed in something, that is neither one nor the other, but we probably don't have time to get into that. But in any event, I of course, agree with MacTonie's observations also on matrix simulation possibilities. We know he was familiar with Nick Bostrom's matrix simulation hypothesis, you know, which is basically that post-singularity civilization should be able to create a matrix world. And if there is that possibility, well, there's a possibility, perhaps even a probability, that such has already happened and that we ourselves actually might be living in such a simulation. Now, I don't know if Tony's had read Chalmers' matrix theories. I just don't know. But what one has to be aware of in this context is that these scholarly hypotheses, you know, can be quite different from the scenario in the Matrix movies, because there's always the possibility that a Matrix world might be entirely physical, you know, and entirely real, you know, being generated by a technological mastery of the implicate order. Mm-hmm. Now, Tony's held to the standard transhumanist idea of nanotechnology, you know, and that the nanotechnology could be employed, you know, in the creation of matrix worlds, matrix simulation programs, whereas I envision something more advanced, namely, you know, post-singularity humans, and even something beyond post-humanity, something I call the Homo mechanicus or mechanized humanity, you know, coming to the point of achieving mastery, not only of nanotechnology, but of the implicate order. And so that this would give Homo mechanicus the capability or the very power of creation. It could generate space and time, generate matter, generate consciousness.
Which is interesting. If we're looking at a time, you know, as well as a space that exists indefinitely, we also see a sort of, I don't know that you'd want to call them people at this point, but what you're describing is, you know, some sort of a consciousness that, like you said, has the ability to create. You know, does that bring into question the notion that, you know, we are influencing aspects of our own existence here on planet Earth from the future or from some other point in what we perceive as time?
I would say that's a distinct possibility, and I don't think there's anything in mainstream physics today that would make that impossible. Even Stephen Hawking changed his mind on the question of reverse trajectory time travel. In other words, he thinks that it is possible, at least theoretically in principle, to travel backwards in time. I would qualify that, you know, by saying that, you know, I would speak of what we perceive of as the past or the future, because if time really is just an approximation of a more fundamental underlying reality, in other words, if time doesn't exist, you know, as something that flows, and then how can there be a past to travel to?
Exactly.
In other words, you can't travel to something that doesn't exist, you know, or that only exists as a simulacrum. Or you could travel to a simulacrum of the past. You know, this, I think, makes more sense than the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. But that's probably a separate topic.
Oh, indeed.
But you know, Tony's did argue. You know, he presented the scenario where the crypto-terrestrials, you know, a race of earthlings existing unseen alongside Homo sapiens, you know, had probably made a breakthrough to singularity. I think that it's more likely, at least I make the proposal that, for me, it makes more sense that the UFO phenomenon may possibly be related to, but to ourselves in the future. That is, what if, as Nick Bostrom argues, you know, that the singularity has been achieved, and that a matrix program, a matrix world, has been created by our descendants, and that they are interacting with us in that simulation. And what if they have inserted themselves into that simulation since the dawn of human history, if not before? The motivations for that would be a separate question. If that's the case, you know, there should be some signs, either, you know, pointing towards a confirmation or disconfirmation of that possibility when the singularity arrives, which Kurzweil, you know, predicts could be here, you know, within just a few decades.
Oh, yeah, by 2029, you know, and if that's the case, yeah, and the ultimate realization of all this could be right around the corner. We may have more answers in the next few decades than most people probably could imagine right now.
Yes. So in that sense, let's say the extraterrestrial hypothesis, well, you really won't have much evidence for that until, you know, we have nuts and bolts craft in our hands and we can somehow prove that it's from another solar system, which, you know, I think would be problematic in itself. But this transhumanist possibility, and I stress it's only a possibility, this transhumanist possibility that, you know, UFOs may involve a technology from our own future, there could be at least some type of evidence, at least pointing in the direction of confirmation or disconfirmation within our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which for a hypothesis or theory to be good, it has to be falsifiable. So this particular theory, I think, can be falsifiable, not at present, but perhaps within our lifetime.
Fascinating. And that, to me, truly is a unique theory as to the origins of UFOs. Dr. Kammerer, the time, rather the clock has caught us, but I do want to thank you so much for coming and making these statements. To borrow the term, I think, used by another very astute researcher of strange phenomena, very clear for us, quite clear, in fact. So, again, it is our pleasure to remember Mac Tonies and also explore new concepts right here with you on the Graylian Report. Thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. My pleasure, Micah.
And that wraps up another edition of the Graylian Report. On behalf of all the fine folks that make this program what it is each week, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Engineer Matt Oakley, Producer Chris Hayes, and of course, yours truly, the Mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, and listeners like you who send us your insights and opinions and help us make this program everything it can be, and of course, something that you'd like to listen to on a weekly basis, we bid you adieu. I am your host, Micah Hanks. It's the Graylian Report. We'll be back next week, and in the meantime, stay strange.